very nice sunny Monday, so we're going to go quick for everyone, including myself and Senator Starr, who we've welcomed back once, but Senator Starr had surgery. He's amazing. I think he had it like 2 days ago or 3 days ago, and I thought he'd be out for a year, and he shows up today. So you'd never know it, but he just went through relatively major surgery.
Serious back surgery.
Yep. Looks good, and thank you for making it here this afternoon.
You bet.
It's good to be here.
I'm not sure I could say that, but I'll defer to you that it's good to be here. Okay, so we're going to open let's do the two House bills. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3453, and then we'll hear the 3454 issue in Klamath Falls. Good afternoon. Yeah, we're going to do 3453.
Right. House Bill 3453 exempts from property tax any tangible or intangible property whose use arises between a qualified governmental entity and an energy marketing company. A qualified government entity is a public body defined by a particular statute, which includes state government bodies, locally owned government bodies, and special government bodies. And the bill applies to tax years beginning on or after 2006. As background for this bill, it was initiated actually during the interim session by Pacific Power Marketing because of a tax court decision that is currently or was currently under appeal at the time I initially did this a month or two ago. And in the case of PPM versus the Department of Revenue, the tax court ruled in the department's favor with respect to a property tax assessment of roughly $0.9 million for 2002. The assessment was based on the DOR's position that PPM's use of tangible and intangible real or personal property owned by a qualified governmental entity was subject to tax. The tax court ruled that the contracts between PPM and the governmental entity had a value that represented the intangible property that was subject to property tax under current law, irrespective of whether the contracts conveyed a possessory interest in the property. Under current law, centrally assessed property can be both tangible and intangible property, but governmentally owned property is typically exempt from property tax. When the city of Klamath Falls contracted with PPM, it transferred rights to PPM to the use of its city property. The city's property tax exemption was not transferable, according to DOR's position. The House bill will confer this exemption on PPM and other qualified energy marketing companies that have contracts with qualified governmental entities. There are several city-owned electric generating plants located in Oregon. However, according to a representative of the largest entity, which is Eugene Water and Electric Board, it does not currently have a contract with an energy marketing company that resembles the contract between PPM and the city of Klamath Falls. In other words, based on the data that I reviewed and the cities that I contacted, the bill would pertain pretty much to PPM versus the city-owned electric generating plant that's Klamath Falls. That's an interesting.
Thank you. Yes, Chair Starr.
I don't have my materials together. I don't have the staff major summary on this bill in my file. And we have stuck it someplace else, but I can't find it.
Mm-hmm. Sorry about that.
Thank you.
Other questions? Tom, Representative Tom Butler, Chair of the House Revenue Committee. And if you would like, I'd be more than happy to open a public hearing on 3454. You have a nice flower on your lapel. Open a public hearing on 30
squirt water.
House Bill 3454.
I have children that love me for Father's Day, I think, is what happened, Senator. Thank you. good afternoon. I'm Tom Butler from House District 60. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My purpose today is to attend to give you a little bit of the background. Staff done an excellent job in giving you some of that The original PPM Energy bill came forward with the concerns that was it how far were we going to extend the issue of the intangibles tax? And the concern was, and you'll hear testimony today, that much of this intangible came about probably as more of a mistake than anything else, and certainly the Department of Revenue received counsel from the Department of Justice that here's what the law says, you take it by the four corners and you just apply this law. And even though the public entities that are involved have certain rights, the difficulty that we saw was that it appeared that there was a contract right that was being taxed as a public utility, which really wasn't intended. You'll also hear testimony that had this been anything more than an oversight, was what it appeared to us, that had these folks anticipated that there would be a tax involved here, a property tax, they would have gone ahead and opted under the enterprise zone, and this issue would not be something we'd be addressing here today. And then with regard to the second bill, which spawned out of this, was the issue with regard to the intertie, the use of the intertie by the cities of Seattle and Tacoma. Those are two municipal cities in the state of Washington, similar to any other city in the state of Oregon, except that they are physically situated outside of the state boundaries. We felt like in House Revenue that even though these two cities were part of a lawsuit, and the chair is aware that the judges in the lawsuit are asking for a legislative fix, if we can come up with a legislative fix in the meantime, that it would still be good policy to treat our neighbors to the north and south and east of us with the same courtesy that we would treat our own cities. So remember, in this world of high electronics and great competition, that your competition is never more than eighth of a second away from you anywhere in the entire world, and we wanted to stretch out and make sure that cities in Washington were afforded the same opportunity for use of the intertie as anyone in the state of Oregon. Now, that the other concern that I have is that Oregon is unique in its treatment of the tax on these kinds of intangibles. I don't know how many states, maybe back east, they might have figured out a way to tax a contract like this, because the property that's situated in the state of Oregon is already subject to tax or is subject to ownership by federal government or those kinds of things. This is something that's new. It's something that's been relatively recently thrashed out. The concern that we have here is that Oregon depends upon the state of Washington for the delivery of our natural gas lines, the natural gas through those lines. And if we don't extend to Washington the same kind of courtesy for the delivery of electricity that we would ask them to extend to us for the delivery of our natural gas lines, then there's a pretty good possibility that we could get ourselves eventually into a taxing war, and that's just a race to the bottom. So we felt like that this was an equity situation. And finally, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we've asked the leadership in the House that the entire issue of intangibles at some point need to be addressed, and that this would be a good interim place to go and examine the other issues that nibble around the edges of the entire intangibles, but that this appeared to be, with regard to these two issues, just a simple question of fairness with regard to the city of Klamath Falls and the city of Seattle and the city of Tacoma.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Butler? Do you see on 3453, and not to skip around, do you see in any way that would be precedent setting? I know that we're dealing with one example here of Southern Oregon, but in any way would that be precedent setting in terms of how we do generation facilities and how we might do public-private partnerships that would put this into place, and would there be a real strong incentive to use that as the model for tax benefit purposes?
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent question, and there's folks that have done a lot more analysis on this than have I, but certainly in the situation with the city of Klamath Falls, the intent was that they would like to remain an economic engine unto themselves. And so the fact that they bonded and built the facility and have worked through all of those issues themselves, what you have here is you have the treatment of the operating agreement in effect that's becoming intangible. And with regard to the precedent setting, that's an area that I don't know that I would want the state to continue. Mr. Chair, because it involves the management of an electrical utility, one example that I used, and again, I'm not a lawyer and a deep thinker like most of these people that surround this whole issue are, but the way that I had it figured out was, wait a minute, if I was providing another service, let's say I was the accountant in this process that was doing the number crunching, and I had a contract that was to not manage the delivery of the utility and sell it, but I was there to try and was given a contract throughout the United States to figure out how we were going to bill for each of these various components and those kinds of things. It wouldn't be long before my contract would be subject to a property tax. Now, I pay income tax on it, and that's not the question here. It's just the additional property tax. And so I just fear that the precedents that are being set as the department is given direction. I've visited at length with Director Harchenko, and she said, no, we've received the counsel from the Department of Revenue, and then we make up our own minds as to how we're going to proceed. It's not as to who's in the driver's seat. She's assured me that she remains in the driver's seat. But it's the encroachment into the field piece by piece. How far can we get before? And I guess that's really what taxation is all about. It's plucking the feathers off the goose one at a time until it starts to honk louder than what we can tolerate. So,
where can we go with that one?
Other questions for the... Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Send us a note with the OSU baseball score.
Yeah.
Read it through at last.
What is the latest?
Baylor scored, what, one run? So Baylor was up 3-2 in the fifth inning. Paul will keep us. He probably got it on the radio over there. If he jumps up and down, it doesn't mean we're passing anything or it's for the game. Okay, so Sean Miller, Norm Ross, Mike Roberts, Team PPM.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Sean Miller representing PPM Energy today. And in support of House Bill 3453, you heard from staff. This was an issue that we brought forth in the interim into Representative Butler's interim revenue committee based on the tax decision that you've heard that essentially tax the contract that PPM Energy has with the city of Klamath Falls, who wholly owns that cogeneration facility. And the public policy debate that will obviously before your committee will be whether that contract is, if there's a possessory interest in that contract. And we say no, there is not a possessory interest in that contract because it is wholly owned by the city of Klamath Falls. And that'll be the crux of the debate today, Mr. Chairman. And with me, Norm Ross is the property tax manager, and Mike Roberts, who's the former plant manager down in the city of Klamath Falls, is here to go through why we believe this bill is needed and also available for any questions afterward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Norman Ross. I'm here today to offer testimony in support of House Bill 3453, speaking on behalf of PPM. PPM Energy appreciates your consideration of this important piece of legislation. Mm-hmm. House Bill 3453 was drafted to address a very narrow assessment issue that arose following an issuance of a property tax assessment by the Department of Revenue in 2002. Just for your frame of reference, I was notified as the contact for PPM approximately 3 or 4 days prior to the issuance of the assessment that the Department of Revenue intended to follow this path. So unlike most tax assessment processes where the company's notified months and months in advance that it has forms to fill out, information to supply to the department in fact initiated this process within days of the timeline for actually sending out the assessment notice. So it was a complete surprise to the company. The assessment at issue, as Sean indicates, involves a commodity supply contract. PPM holds a contract which permits it to buy, I believe it's roughly 47% of the output of the city-owned generating plant. The contract is typically called a purchase power agreement, or PPA for short. The department's assessment in each of the years beginning in 2002 has been exclusively based on the portion of the facility's output that PPM has agreed to buy. So it's exclusively driven by the contract to purchase power. We believe that the assessment of this commodity supply contract is fundamentally unfair for the following reason. The department has failed to issue similar assessments for similar contract rights for similarly situated parties. In other words, there are quite a number of other parties that have power purchase agreements with otherwise non-taxable generation facilities. Think first of the BPA facilities that cross Oregon and Washington borders. So numerous parties buy contract or buy power from those facilities. The city has not gone, or excuse me, the department has not moved to assess the other buyers of power out of the city-owned facility, the Klamath's facility as well. So it has singled out PPM for this unique and, we believe, discriminatory treatment. We believe that the assessment represents poor tax policy as well. In this instance, the contract right is tied to the ability the company has to buy electric power from the city-owned facility. As a consequence, the value for assessment purposes will be tied over time to the value of that underlying commodity. This is the first and, to the best of my knowledge, only instance where the department has moved to issue a property tax assessment for a commodity supply contract. We believe it's poor tax policy because of the inherent volatility of tying property tax base to a volatile commodity. I'd like to offer a couple of thoughts concerning what you're likely to hear from the counties as they have their opportunity before you today. In the first instance, the counties will likely suggest that they believe PPM is a part owner of the facility, that PPM is in fact just a partner with the city on this facility. That's entirely incorrect. The city is owned in fee simple interest entirely by, excuse me, the facility is owned in fee simple interest entirely by the city of Klamath Falls. PPM has no property rights whatsoever for the facility. It has no possessory interest in the facility, which is a term of art that's somewhat unique to Oregon. It is merely buying the power from the facility and providing management related services to the facility for those particular skill sets the city employees do not possess. The city could go to anyone, any number of companies to provide, to obtain those same same type of management services. The county will also likely suggest the passage of this bill will create some hardship to the various taxing districts. This too, I believe, is incorrect. Because of PPM's appeal of this the tax assessment beginning in 2002, every dollar of tax that has been paid, and please understand that PPM has paid each of those assessments, every dollar of those taxes is currently sitting in an escrow account awaiting the resolution of those appeals having been filed by PPM. So the taxing entities have not, in fact, grown dependent upon the tax revenues initiated by this assessment. So that we don't believe that there's a hardship because of the that would occur because of the passage of this bill. Concerning what you're likely to hear from the Department of Revenue, the department will likely state that PPM's relationship with the city makes it equivalent to an owner, not unlike the county's argument. We believe that that's incorrect. It's based, again, on an inadequate understanding of the arrangement between the city and PPM Energy. Mike Roberts is here to describe more fully some of those, some of that relationship, so you have a better grasp of that. Like the county, the department fails to understand that power purchase agreements are commonplace within the electric power industry. By buying or agreeing to buy power on a long-term basis, we're not taking ownership of the facility, and we shouldn't be paying property tax for that. The department will also likely state that it merely followed its statutory mandate when issuing its assessment to PPM. We believe that the department's actions are particularly puzzling in light of past history. Several sessions ago, I participated in a utility work group that sought to obtain an exemption for intangible property for utility taxpayers. In fact, the legislature, I believe, has taken that up three times in the last 10 to 12 years. And in each instance, I think the bills were passed and the governor vetoed those bills. During that process, the most recent process, the department was emphasizing very strenuously that they did not wish to be put in a position where they would be called upon to value, to assign a value to contract rights, a very difficult and technically demanding area of appraisal practice. Now, the department's issuance of its assessment to PPM Energy has put them squarely in the position which they sought to avoid, and this bill will help them exit that that difficulty. At this point in time, they have yet to actually assign a true value to the contract rights. We believe that the value that they have assigned, which is based on a portion of the city's construction costs for the facility, not PPM's contract right, grossly exceeds the actual value, even if we did have a possessory interest in that in the facility. The department also fails to openly acknowledge that PPM is the only taxpayer that they have singled out for this unique and, we believe, discriminatory assessment. One of the challenging issues you face as legislators is to know where to draw the line for tax purposes, which types of activities are going to be subject to tax and which types of activities are going to fall outside that that assessment base. The department issued its assessment in this instance in 2002, and I am persuaded that in the 3 years that have passed, they have yet to formulate a coherent explanation defining where that line is to be drawn. Obviously, at this point in time, they're believing that PPM is within that assessment line, but they have not defined whatsoever who else might be. And it's imperative that businesses have some predictable sense of what their tax liability will be, particularly on events of this size. In summary, we believe that the department, in issuing the assessment in 2002 and in each of the subsequent years, has followed an unsound assessment practice, which is discriminatory and we believe in conflict with the Oregon Constitution. We would ask for your support in passing House Bill 3453. If there's any questions, I could certainly answer those at this time.
Thank you. Mr. Roberts.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time. My name is Mike Roberts. Here today to just give a little background on the plant itself, and then and the relationship between PPM and the city, and then really just kind of open it up for questions to the extent there are questions. It's been mentioned I was the plant manager. I was the manager on site from the time of plant construction through December of last year, and I've since taken a new position within PPM up in Portland, but I feel pretty familiar with the plant itself and the relationship. So I'm going to spend just a couple of minutes on that, like I said, and then we'll move on. This is my take on the whole situation. Is a pretty entrepreneurial move by the city to conceive construction of a plant at a time when the market was kind of hit and miss. That nevertheless, the city came up with this idea and arranged financing for the construction of a power plant. That wasn't this one. It was a plant that ultimately was never able to be permitted. It happened to be a hydroelectric facility. But in any case, at one point in the mid-90s, the city of Klamath Falls still hung on to the idea and found that by putting several pieces of the puzzle together, they could ultimately finance and oversee construction and ownership of a combined cycle power plant. This happens to be a 484 megawatt combined cycle power plant, burns natural gas. Like I said, it was built in the late 90s, went commercial in 2001. I'm not too sure how interested everybody is on the details, so I'm just going to kind of skip over the details and then be available for the more detailed questions at the end. But in any case, it is high tech. That is the point I'm really trying to make here. It's high tech. It's not the kind of thing that a city municipality like the city of Klamath Falls could just march out and go. They don't necessarily possess the skill set to just go out and finance that and build it and operate it and know all the details. So that's what the city did as part of the kind of portfolio of services in addition to financing and finding the right location. They found a service provider in PPM. I don't think our name was PPM at the time. I think it was PacifiCorp Power Marketing. In any case, they found somebody. As was mentioned earlier, there are a number of companies that offer these kind of services. They're basically good at operations and maintenance, the nuts and bolts of running a power plant. And that's why they hired PacifiCorp Power Marketing, now PPM Energy. And it was my role for years to show up for work every day in the plant, manage the people, study the issues, and time came, take a recommendation to the owner. And so it's obvious to me, maybe almost too obvious or too evident that the that relationship between service provider and owner, and I was reminded that quite a bit. In any case, I want to mention just a couple of things of other things, I guess maybe perhaps fringe issues, but this it may not be obvious that a project, a business venture of this size, is not it's not a slam dunk that it's going to be economically viable. And there are a lot of things that have to fall into place. Certainty around tax issues is one of the things that you kind of like to know how you're going to be treated further on down the road before you go ahead and do a project. In any case, this project went forward with a basic assumption that PPM service provider, PPM priced the various services correctly with the understanding of with the then understanding of tax laws. And I'll have to say this was a surprise to us. Maybe this isn't the right form to go into all that, but it's certainly a surprise and unwelcome development to learn that you have expectations and then in terms of your ownership, you're providing a service, and the next thing you know you're being asked to pay property tax on providing a service, and that's certainly in our eyes not appropriate. Anyway, that's not, I don't want to go into that too much because we have better people to represent that view. I think I pretty much made my point about what the relationship is between the city, PPM Energy. We're not the same thing as a public works department or the streets department, or kind of police services. Those are things that a city could could manage quite well. This is not the case with a combined cycle power plant. Very essentially high-tech work, and they were just not set up to run that kind of business, so they farmed it out, and that's what we do. So,
John, do you want to add something?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I you know, one of the points, again, Sean Miller, PPM Energy, that you'll also hear is why not let the Supreme Court decide? You've heard that the tax decision is on appeal, and, you know, one of the lines, I think, the public policy decisions that you all have to make is whether or not you, at the Supreme Court level, if the money that Norm talks about is put into escrow, again, we view that as not money that was expected in the county. And it's in escrow right now. If we were to actually win in that Supreme Court decision, you know, they obviously have to pay that money back with interest. And so it's an issue that, again, I think is something we don't believe it should have ever been paid. And then when you want to look at the payment argument, one of the issues, I think it was in your initial question, you know, one of the ways we look at it, since we just have a contract with the city of Klamath Falls, in the end, or those contracts can be renegotiated. And obviously from our standpoint in running a business, we can basically build that into the contract price where the city would end up paying the property taxes. And so here you have initially a city who is supposed to be exempt from property taxes who built the cogen facility, a service provider, PPM Energy. If we build that tax into our contract, then, you know, the county wants the money. Then essentially, if you think about it, it's a roundabout way for the city to pay for the tax for the county. And is that what you want in government in this particular case? And it's something for you all to think about as this is a public-private partnership. We believe if, you know, since this bill only affects us right now, obviously if this was in effect in this kind of relationship, if the city or a county or everybody else wanted to do this, we believe it would not happen in the future. It just couldn't happen. If they're expected to pay property taxes, we believe that this public-private partnership would not exist in this capacity.
Questions for this panel? Senator Dorgan Simetsker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm reading an article from the Herald and News out of Klamath Falls. They make a statement that they believe that the plant actually is owned by the city, even though they tell us to vote no on the bill. So the question is that, does the city own the facility? Did they bond to buy it? Did the people vote? You don't mind me asking the question. Everybody's shaking their head yes.
Yeah.
But they did.
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, yes, it's wholly owned by the city of Klamath Falls, bonded, and there is no, as Norm said, possessory interest that PPM has in that. If they want to sell it, we can't say no. If they want to get a new service provider, and so this argument that we have a 47% ownership right is, in our opinion, completely wrong.
Mr. Chairman, that was my second question. Thank you. I think that makes it clear that it is two separate entities.
Thank you. Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Chairman Decker. Just a question. These are interesting. We've got two actually interesting bills today in trying to ascertain just kind of the veracity of some of these arguments here. With PPM, and I don't know who's the most, whoever would like to chime in on this one, financially, is PPM doing well? I mean, are you okay with how the operations are going in the western states? Is this a ongoing, is this a, are you moving towards profitability, or is this a...
You mean PPM as a whole?
Yeah.
I suppose I'll take this one on. I'd like to think that PPM is doing okay. I'm not sure how relevant that is to a property tax question, but forgive me. PPM sees opportunities in the renewable energy markets and have been actively pursuing that for the last few years, as opposed to more of this kind of business. What PPM is doing in this case is providing operations and maintenance services. So we go out and find the technical people to run this power plant. PPM also has activities known as business development origination, where on behalf of the city as a broker, go out and try to find creditworthy counterparties to buy the output off these power plants. The market is a pretty tough place right now in the Northwest. So this going out and getting more of this kind of work is not exactly what I would say. That's not the primary focus of PPM right now. I'm trying to give you a flavor.
Okay. Well, and I'll say where I'm going in this, but I'm just with the we're talking. You talked about tax certainty and the importance, and whether we would go into these ventures again. And so I'm replaying some former testimony, and I'm trying to get some comment. PacifiCorp has been, maybe sold to the Buffett Group. It has been closely aligned with PPM under Scottish Power, and with if in fact the sale goes through and they're buying PacifiCorp, not PPM, I'm trying to understand the linkage between can PPM survive without PacifiCorp as a partner under Scottish Power. I'm just as a standalone entity in this state.
I think the short answer to that is yes. The two companies, PacifiCorp and PPM Energy, have been independent in the truest sense of the word for years. They're essentially PPM Energy is indifferent to the PacifiCorp sale to the Mid-American.
Well, the point I was just going to make, Mr. Chairman, is that because part of this, we have an issue of what's proper with taxes with the city and ownership, and trying to decide that. Also, from a public policy, since we'd be setting tax policy here, in trying to encourage relationships that work in partnerships. And but part of earlier testimony we had when we were dealing with the issue of utility taxes, we had representative from PPM saying that they were actually tied at the hip with PacifiCorp, and without that cash stream, of which the taxes were a significant part of, that we would lose 200 jobs, the company would no longer be viable, might have to lose to Utah, and now the company's leaving, and PPM doesn't seem to be tied to them anymore. And I'm just trying to take those, that claim of, gee, this is going to ruin jobs, it's bad policy, we need to have cash flow from PacifiCorp to exist. Now they go away, and we have the argument seems to be different. And I'm just trying to understand the relationship there.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, that's a good question. I think when PPM Energy first started, and again, it's a company that's based in Portland, Oregon, with roughly 200 employees throughout the state, and has grown very rapidly from a very small renewable energy company to the world's one of the world's largest, second in wind generation, and hope to be first. A lot of the incentives for that private company to be able to grow that rapidly was under the PacifiCorp Holdings umbrella. And so, again, that company did develop as a very, what we believe, a very successful company, and one that I think Oregon should want to have here. You did, Senator Metzger, mention that, we are in the midst of possibly changing our relationship, PacifiCorp, and that company would still be under the Scottish Power, and we don't know how that arrangement's going to be, but you're absolutely right. It'll be a part of that company and under the existing, transition, PacifiCorp will be severed from PPM Energy. But again, I think the growth and the development of that very successful company was part and still is part of that debate that you talked about.
So my question is, and I guess I kind of tip my hat with the first one. Obviously, you have, and this is a tough one for me. I see both sides of this issue. I mean, you have the Supreme Court sitting out there ready to adjudicate this, and so that always gives us some level of comfort that there are good, smart people ready to involve themselves. But secondly, I'm just wondering, and I would appreciate your perspective, is that are we clarifying the law with this, or are we setting new tax policy? And I think of, if I'm sitting at PG and I just did Port Westward, which I'm paying all the requisite taxes on, if we enact this and I go out, and hopefully you, PPM, PG, anyone would go out and still want to generate new electricity for the state and for the region and all the good things that come with that and the jobs and the income, why would I not use this to defray, at least on a smaller project than that one, $2 million annually or biannually of expenses on my project? And so that leans me towards, we're making new tax policy for generating facilities away from the traditional model into this new model, and perhaps that's where we should have the discussion, is this the new tax policy that we want? But I would be happy. You're in the field. You know this area better than I, and so I'd be happy to be convinced otherwise that this is really more of an anomaly of something that a city really took on.
Well, Norm Ross speaking. Chairman, committee members, I think this needs to be looked at as an isolated extension of the Department of Revenue's assessment practices, because the department never before extended its assessment reach to capture this type of an intangible asset. And it has not, and it's done so very selectively.
But is there something, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, is there something very similar that we could look to in Oregon of this type of partnership? Or is the department, I don't want to speak for him, just saying, well, we've never seen this before, and so we're having to...
That's the case. Mr. Chairman, I believe that's the case. Construction of a cogeneration facility, it's only occurred one time in Oregon. That's the city of Klamath Falls that owns it and runs it, obviously with the contracts with PPM Energy. I don't know if that's going to happen in the future, if any local governments. What this bill attempts to do is, in that specific instance where Klamath Falls was wanted to own their own cogeneration facility, that this only deals with that intangible tax of what we believe was new tax policy when they made that determination, because we don't believe, or we believe from the very beginning, that it would we would be exempt. And if there was any question at the time, like you've heard from Representative Butler, the city would have gone under the enterprise zone statutes or applied for that. And so I don't know if it necessarily changes any current tax policy or any development. It really only deals with what Norm says, an anomaly, and that is a city owning a cogeneration facility, which under this bill, I mean, we only have one in the state. Under the bill, it only would affect one taxpayer. And that's us, because we're the only ones who have contracts with them.
So, Sean, so the next time y'all go out, and I hope there is a next time, why wouldn't you just use, we pass this, and maybe it's not such a bad thing, but that's a different
city.
Just let's find a new city, do it, partner with that city, and we'll, or county, and we'll just do it that way and use the statute to have a lower construction cost than operating.
Well, going, Chairman, members of the committee, Norm Ross, going back to the comments I issued earlier, that I think this type of an assessment is a matter of bad tax policy in the sense that it is tied to a commodity. You know, if we had in fact owned 47% of the facility, meaning we subsidized 47% of the construction cost of that facility, we would not be before you today. We would acknowledge that we have an ownership interest in tangible and intangible property that's subject to assessment by the department, and we would contend with them on the basis of that assessment. But we believe that the assessment is tied exclusively to the intangible contract right, and there's a volatility inherent in that, that this issue has not played out all the way. The issue before the Supreme Court was merely whether, and the decision that is forthcoming, hopefully, is merely whether the department had a constitutionally permitted right to assess us, assess PPM on that contract right, not whether the value that they assigned was appropriate. We believe that the value issue is much more substantial and will create a situation of a great deal of volatility in the tax base. So as a matter of tax policy, I believe it's preferable to exclude these types of intangible rights from the tax base.
Mr. Chairman, if I can try to answer that question. What you were inferring is, let's say the city of Beaverton wants to say, we want to own a cogeneration facility, and we say, go do that. Go build it so we would be exempt from property taxes and get get out of it if nothing were to happen and that was the practice. I don't think we are going to be pushing for those kind of circumstances. That would be an individual decision by any local government. And what we said, if a local government wants to do it and they're exempt from property taxes, if they contract, you're not going to tax on the facility based on that contract.
So not to just kind of beat this, but it was was Klamath Falls well down the track on this before, and then they said, well, PPM would be a good administrator of this?
PPM, maybe I should, a clarifying question. You're talking about prior to the construction of the plant?
Yeah, I mean, how far along were they when they thought, well, let's talk to PPM? Have they made all the decisions, basically, to, we're going forward, we're doing this?
It has always been, this has always been the city's project. It's always been their call. City Council approved it.
Talk to them before the City Council approved it?
Certainly, PPM provided assistance in terms of establishing some financial models. You know, this is what it might look like.
You were in at the ground. I mean, not that this is determinative. You were at the end of the ground floor thinking this thing through.
Early days, I was not around, but... There was a number of consultants helping the city to make the decision as to whether it was made good financial sense to go forward. So the predecessor to PPM Energy, there was, PPM's in the energy business. So PPM does have opinions about what it costs to do business, what you can sell electricity products for, what does it pay for fuel, so on and so forth. We're also somewhat experienced in understanding the issues around getting a site permitted and actually managing construction. That's skill sets that PPM and its predecessors hold or have held for many years. So it's the direct answer to your question is, PPM's was consulted, yes.
Early on. Mary, did you want to add something?
Yes, I just was under the impression that maybe the Department of Revenue staff can come on it, but generally I think all centrally assessed property, all income-generating property is based on like an income approach to the assessment. So it wouldn't be, when you're saying we've not been assessed before based on a volatile product, but in actuality I'm not sure that doesn't get included in assessments of all types of commercial property, including centrally assessed property.
Chairman, legislative staff, in this, you are correct that there are several methodologies that the department may employ when valuing utility property, the cost approach, an income approach, and certain types of market approaches. However, in this instance, there has been no attempt to look at the income-related considerations when valuing this particular intangible contract right. The department has simply assumed in issuing its assessment that PPM Energy owns 47% of that facility, and so it has set PPM's assessment equal to 47% of the city's construction cost. And so in this instance, my comments earlier were designed to convey that we don't believe the department has in fact appropriately valued the contract right, even if it was proper to value the contract right or to include that right in the assessment base. So
thank you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
If you want to stay with us, we might have more questions for you after we're finished with everyone else. Mr. Riddell, Commissioner Switzer, and John, do you want to come up and we'll kind of use this as our panel to understand the alternative point of view? Mr. Phillips from the Department of Revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. With me is Al Switzer, Chairman of the Board of Commissioners of Klamath County and past AOC President. Do you want John to introduce himself at this point, or should we just do our thing and then...
Yeah, do your thing.
Okay.
Do his thing.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have a couple of written items there, and one in particular on top that I'll be addressing, attached to it, the local paper's editorial saying this should be resoundingly defeated. This bill received no votes from both Klamath County representatives and is opposed by Senator Doug Whitsitt, who represents Klamath County. And I must say, in spite of what you've heard, we are not going to characterize PPM and the City of Klamath Falls as one and the same. We are not going to claim that PPM owns the facility. Civic Power Marketing is a private for-profit power marketing firm that has various contracts with the City of Klamath Falls for the right to use public property, the cogeneration plant, for private gain. This is really very simple, and it's like numerous other situations with the same tax treatment, where city-owned property is leased to enterprises who operate the property under contract, and those private companies are taxed. This is, frankly, garden variety Oregon law, property tax law. PPM has lost its appeal in tax court. This is an end run, plain and simple. We don't think it's necessary to debate what's going on in the judicial system right now, because it's very simple, and let the Supreme Court do its work. We're confident that the state will prevail. Since this bill applies to all like private public agreements, it breaks new policy ground. This will change the policy landscape. This is not particular to a single situation. If you read the bill, it has general language. It applies generally. It is a statement of policy, and you're making a significant change to tax policy. In addition to that, you are providing a competitive advantage to a private for-profit firm who seeks to be treated as a public body. The plant was financed by bonds, mostly tax-exempt, at a more favorable interest rate. And the removal of property tax obligations puts PPM well ahead of the market, well ahead in the market against its private competition. This is an unnecessary property tax expenditure. It will cost $1 million annually to local districts in Klamath County, and will cost, in effect, the schools and state school fund will be told, in effect, that they should pay to this private for-profit energy marketing firm over $720,000 a biennium of education resources. To become law, this proposed property tax exemption, which is an expenditure of public funds, should satisfy a test of compelling statewide interest, immediate need, and agreement of affected local jurisdictions. We have local tools available that involve all jurisdictions. We have enterprise zones. We have strategic investment initiatives. We have lots of things rather than a straight-on state, one-size-fits-all property tax exemption to current law. ALC has shown good faith by supporting new property tax expenditures, for example, for primary agriculture processing, Senate Bill 479, which came out of this this committee, and we support, and we'll like to see it pass. That, however, demonstrably met the test, and this does not. Property tax system is already cut and capped. There are other means of dealing with this, as I say, and there's local tools that provide flexibility. And I believe Senator Whitsitt has come in, and he can speak for himself about his opposition to this. As I mentioned, the local papers opposed, and the two representatives from Klamath County voted no on the bill in the House.
I'm going to join your County Commissioner, Senator Whitsitt. One of you can stay.
Thank you, Chair Deckert.
Next door.
Committee members. Here. For the record, I'm Doug Whitsitt, Senator from Senate District 28. No, ORS 307.04090 never intended to exempt generation facilities owned by a city or any other tax-exempt entity listed in 307.090, but operated for a for-profit utility for their own profitability. It intended for the public entity to both own and operate such a facility for the exclusive benefit of the constituents of that public entity. Basically, this is what the tax court has ruled. HB 3453 codifies the precedent into law that private utilities that partner with state government agencies are exempt from property tax, or may be exempt from property tax. This precedent, in my opinion, will result in many new private-public partnerships. And why would they not? It exempts them from property tax. This is an ill-advised legislation. I urge you to vote no. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Senator Whitsitt? Thank you.
Senator George.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator George.
Senator, in the article, it says that local politicians who can contribute a shell-like tax exemption in exchange for control over a stream of profit. Do you believe that occurred in Klamath Falls?
I believe that our tax assessor, Reggie LeCue, is quite convinced that this is a method of excluding a privately owned portion of the entity from the tax rules in Klamath County, yes.
Thank you.
Now, Mr. Chair, Mr. Schweitzer has some comments, too.
That was the trip over. I've been updated on your trips from Klamath Falls to Portland. Or to
I think the car almost goes by itself.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Al Schweitzer, Klamath County Commissioner, and I have some prepared statements of why our Board of Commissioners opposes HB 3453. First of all, and maybe I should thank the PP&M people since they gave most of my speech, but I will continue down with it as I have it written. The bill will cause significant revenue losses for local districts, and I'll give you a couple of examples. The city and county schools, the community college, the combined total is over $700,000 per biennium. And this is occurring while city schools are laying off teachers. The county schools are cutting hours, increasing class size. And it also occurs while in Klamath County, and I'm sure this is, we're not the only county that has this, that our schools have somewhere in the neighborhood of $40 million in unfunded repairs to their facilities. Our fire districts will lose $137,000 per year. We have a number of rural fire districts. They cannot operate even with what they've got. Now we're going to cut them further. And also I might mention that one of the taxing entities that loses dollars here is the city of Klamath Falls. It's about $99,000 a year. In my opinion, the bill promotes unfair competition. We have a power plant in Klamath County called the Cogen, and we have sited a power plant called the Cobb. Cogen is a city PPM plant, which wants to reverse its responsibility and permanently pay no property taxes. The Cobb, which stands for California-Oregon Border, is a plant that is proposing to have a long-term enterprise zone. And they have agreed, in principle, to pay one-half of their assessment during construction, which they would not have to pay any under the long-term, and would pay to the county a contribution of $2.5 million for the 15 years of a long-term enterprise zone. That is somewhere around $40 million to the county in taxes or tax abatements that they would pay. On year 16, the Cobb plant will then start to pay full taxes. So contrasting the two of them, that's quite a difference. In other words, the county and the Cobb, we play by the rules. We struck a bargain, and we are prepared to live with the bargain. PPM has come to the state legislature to change the rules for their own benefit. The city and PPM agreement is similar to a city-county lease that we have on some publicly held property. And I realize this is a smaller type of thing, but I think it's the same idea. We have a 100-year floodplain basin that we have created. It happens to sit right in some great farmland. So we have leased the farmland out to a private farmer for profit, and he raises alfalfa for profit, and he pays the city and the county the taxes that are due on that land. I believe that this bill does change statewide policy. It does not apply merely to this PPM situation. It would apply to any. PPM has lost in tax court. This is a significant statewide policy change and needs to be made without, should not be made without thorough and thoughtful deliberations. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner. Who built the Cobb plant?
The Cobb plant is not built yet. It is sited. They're going through the process. It will be built by a private company out of Chicago.
And it's a county project, or it's a private utility?
This is private all the way, Mr. Chairman.
Private all the way. Questions for the commissioner? Senator Jarvis.
The first statement in the Association of Oregon Counties bullet point says that PacifiCorp Power Marketing acquired 40% of the Klamath Falls cogeneration plant. They disagree with that.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I apologize. That is a previous in consultation with Department of Revenue about their theories of taxation. That this new handout is meant to supersede that. We are not implying that there's an ownership. An ownership now that PPM has, we think it makes sense. It fits better that it is simply a use of public property for private profit. And that's
so you agree that they don't own 47% of that plant,
Mr. Chair, Senator George. I think that's an issue before the Supreme Court, and I think that's heavy on detail and fact, and I think the purpose here is to address a general statewide policy. My concern is that you understand that the policy change would affect a typical tax treatment of private use of public property. So, Mr. Chair, Senator George, I have no independent opinion about that.
Okay.
Senator Kansky?
I know we're getting ready to hear from the Department of Revenue. I guess what I really want to find out, because what I'm hearing, I think I've heard enough as to what the two sides are. To me, the question is, if this organization, PPN, was actually just operating the facility for Klamath, and it was for the use of the citizens within that, in the sense that they were just an operator, as compared to being in there for actually getting part of the property or the power and then reselling it for profit. And I'd like to have the Department of Revenue kind of walk us through that part, because to me, the difference here, they're not here as an operator of the facility that's owned by the city. They're here basically getting a portion of the energy that's being produced there, then they're turning around and selling it out in the open market. And to me, that's where I think where the tax question really focuses on, you know, what's happening, that what is their actual use of the facility, and is it for the benefit of the owners of that facility, in this case K Falls, or is it for the energy that's coming out of there that they're getting their access to going out in the public market, and open market.
We're going to get to you, Mr. Phillips, in just one moment. I know that's part of your testimony. Commissioner or Senator George?
Are we going to deal with that 53% of the facility that that nobody seems to contest is, in fact, owned by the city? Is that power being used locally? Do they have a right to build a facility that would anticipate growth in their area? And then during the interim, sell that power through PPM for the profit to afford a facility that they will need in the future? I think those are questions we need to have an answer to.
We're going to go right to the department, but I want to give the counties any opportunity to weigh in. If not, we'll just go right to the department.
But, Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that none of that power is sold locally.
Mr.
Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. I just want to make it clear from the outset the department is neutral on this bill. There have been a lot of things said, and I'd like to take a real short time to clarify some things that I've heard that the department doesn't necessarily agree with in interpretation. First of all, we think the property is taxable. It's been stated that this is not a bill that will exempt any property. It's been stated that this is an overreaching by the department. It's been stated that this is clarification and that this is new ground that's being tilled. And I just wanted to state that this is property that is taxable under Oregon law. It is in fact owned by a public entity, and it is under contract. There are use of the property by a private entity. The private entity is taxable. Imagine let's say One example was given by the opponents of the bill. But I'll give you another one. There's spaces in your basement here at the Capitol that are parking spaces. 79 of those spaces are leased to private entities. And those are taxable. And you pay taxes on those. Just like you would any other. I mean, this is a far-reaching policy change if you decide to make public property that's used by a private taxable entity non-taxable. This bill is narrower than that. This bill just states that you would be changing your policy to exempt one energy generation facility under current situation that we know of in Klamath Falls to be exempt. It would not change the statute for other situations as has been for which examples have been given. But if you're thinking along the lines that public property is always non-taxable, then you do need to change the statute in other areas to accomplish that. It's been the practice, it's been the law, and it's been the interpretation for years that any public property that's leased to a taxable entity, use of property is taxable. So I just want to clarify that point.
Could I ask a question?
Yeah,
Senator George.
Is this a lease of the facility, or is this an agreement to purchase the power that's generated by that facility?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I have not personally read the contract, but the PPM Energy is using the property for their purposes. They generate electricity and they sell the energy for their purposes. I can't go into detail with you about the actual provisions of the contract. We can get that's at a level far above where I'm able to communicate. We can have the DOJ attorneys come in and explain that from our perspective, but I think what you want to do is to narrow this to the questions before you, and that's should you exempt one entity in this case from taxation. So if we want to get into the legal arguments, we can certainly I'm not the one to do that, is what I'm saying.
Can I do a follow-up, please? If the city produced the power, I don't care who they hired to operate the facility, and they sold that power, and PP&M bought the power, would it be taxable? Would the facility be taxable?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I think what you'll find in Chapter 307 at the outset, I think it's 090, it says that public property used for corporate purposes is exempt from taxation. Corporate purposes. Now, if you have a city, and it's not a home rule or charter city, and it's dealing in issues that are not statutory allowed, that's one thing. If you have EWEB, for example, out of Eugene, their corporate purpose is exactly that, energy generation. And there's people that can tell you about that. And are they taxable? No. They're not taxable because that is their corporate purpose. If you have a county and they have land, farmland, and somebody's raising corn on it or whatever they grow there, that's not the city or county's corporate purpose. So that's the distinction we draw. That's the distinction the Attorney General's office will draw. That's the distinction the courts will draw. In this case, the Department of Revenue, acting on your behalf, interpreting your laws, has decided this is public property that's not being used for the corporate purpose of Klamath Falls. It's being used by a private entity, therefore it's taxable. We have to gauge how much of that property is being used. We do look to the contract, because that is the map, if you will, to tell us what is going on with this property. You can't look at an energy generation facility and say, 47% of this is being used for private purposes and for profit. But it's the contract that we look to. Another point is that we're taxing intangibles. And if you look at that facility, yes, there's an intangible, if you will, involved with most projects of that size. But what we're taxing is property. It's the use of the property. Sure, it's the City of Klamath Falls property, but it's buildings, it's generators, and all of the other tangible property that's there. So I just wanted to point out that there's a lot of discussion being made about intangible property. And if you are actually at the facility, you would see very tangible property, and that's really what's being taxed. The law provides in this statute under which these properties are assessed, it provides for the taxation of tangible and intangible property. And we don't look at one and say, oh, this is tangible, this is intangible, sort it all out. As was mentioned earlier, we'll probably use three approaches, try to come up with the method that best fits the property. Sometimes that's income. And you look at the income, you back into the value, and then And you don't have to say we assigned so many thousands of dollars to this intangible piece of paper or this this right or this goodwill or whatever the intangible thing is or this piece of property. So that's how we approach the valuation of centrally assessed properties.
I'm trying to deal with some of the arguments that have been brought forward opposing the bill, and one of them is that that these are dollars that are going to be lost to local jurisdictions, you know, if in fact the tax isn't collected. Has any dollar ever been collected from this tax and transferred to a school district or to the county?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, let me preface my remark by saying that the department is not taking a position whatsoever on your decision about whether money should be collected or not. That's totally your policy decision. As a matter of fact, the county has collected the money. PPM has paid the money. The money's in an account under law. 311.812, the county can hold the money and retain the money until the lawsuit is complete.
So no school district or community college or anybody else has ever received a dollar of this?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, not to my knowledge.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I'll take a shot at that. Answer's no. It is in a trusted agency account. By state law, if wherever, whichever way that lawsuit goes, we could end up from the county paying 12% interest on that, which I could sure lobby to have that law changed. But we have not dispersed it, and we are not going to disperse any of that until the lawsuit is settled.
Okay, thanks.
What was, Ms. Phillips, what was the nature, I mean, and this is unfair to ask, but a 30-second synopsis of, I haven't read the tax court decision, and I'm not going to read the tax court decision. What is the 30-second executive summary of their decision and the vote that they took?
Of the Mr. Chair, of the tax court decision in this case?
Yes.
I believe that was Judge Breithoff. And I've read the opinion. It's been a while. I think he agreed that the property was taxable.
It's pretty.
And that decision was appealed. You're familiar with court cases and lawsuits and opinions, and you know that there's a lot of reasonings, arguments, and conclusions. There were, and I'm going to say it on record here, there were parts of that opinion we didn't agree with, and there were clearly parts of the opinion that the PPM did not agree with. We agreed with the result, and so that's why we're pursuing it.
Mary, maybe we should get the opinion and have it available to the committee so at least we can take a look at that and read it if we choose. So.
You mean fall read it and tell us
about
it? Because we don't care if we're going to read it.
Well, I thought I might actually after hearing that.
If I might wrap up then.
Please.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to state that this is a straightforward policy decision. It's for you to decide whether you want to exempt this entity and similarly situated entities. It's not about the fact that we gave 3 to 4 days notice, which I disagree with, that similar assessments to similar entities doesn't occur, which we disagree with, that this is unique and discriminatory, which it's a very commonplace thing, and we disagree with that, that this is value and commodity-based, again. If you want to make the decision about the policy of this energy generation company, please make it on the fact that you're changing policy for this incentive or this change in fairness concept that you have, and that's fine whichever way you decide with us.
Thank you, Mr. Phelps. Questions for the panel? Thank you very much. Thank you for traveling from Klamath Falls to be with us today. Last two on this. Michelle Deister and Bill Linden. Anyone know the score? Committee, we are not going to see the final. Baylor, Oregon State Beavers. Anyone know?
3-3.
3-3 we're getting.
3-3. In the 8th, 9th.
And then, well,
shoot. Who's the home team?
Should we stand in recess?
Who is?
Where?
Who's the home team?
I don't know. It's in Omaha.
OSU?
I know. OSU's home team?
Oh. Well, shoot, this is a tough one for me now. Please proceed.
Please hurry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Michelle Deister, I was hoping to testify on 3454.
Oh, I'm sorry, Michelle.
Okay. So please allow me to excuse myself.
Well, that was Bill, are you the same?
No, I'm on the spot. Bill Linden representing the city of Klamath Falls, and I will be brief. Several points I'd like to make. Number one, the city of Klamath Falls did come to the legislature in the 90s and get specific authorization to construct this plant. I think that's important to keep in context in terms of, you know, there have been some comments made about, you know, a municipality being in this business, but again, it was something that we came and got approval for. There is absolutely no question whatsoever that the facility is 100% city-owned. PPM does not have a possessory interest. They do not have any kind of an interest in the brick and mortar. No question about that. Back when the facility was being constructed and when the city began thinking about what are we going to do with this, they had two options, basically. They could look at the option of hiring city personnel to manage the facility and to market the power, because it was inevitable that there was going to be a power marketing component involved in this facility, just as there is in every energy generation facility. I mean, that's just the economics of the energy market in the modern world, is that you're always going to have to be able to market power. So that was one option, was let's go hire city employees to do that, because obviously they did not have staff with the expertise to manage this type of facility or to engage in the marketing activities that they knew were coming. They felt a better option was to hire a professional firm to provide those services. And that's what they did, and that's why PPM came in the first place. At the time that occurred, the city, and I'm just speaking for the city here, had absolutely no concept whatsoever that the intangible contract right involved in providing those services would be taxable. Because if we had, we would have proceeded under the enterprise zones statute, which would have given us a clear tax exemption, because this facility was constructed in an enterprise zone. So this was a bit of a surprise for everybody. And another point to make about this bill, we have drawn it as narrowly as possible. I do believe it only affects this one situation. The original version that the House heard was broader. But it has been narrowed down to the bare minimum as far as we're concerned. In terms of some of the objections from the county, I mean, obviously, it's brutally clear to you that this is a dispute between Klamath County and the city of Klamath Falls, two local governments who cooperate in many, many, many ways. But this one is, this happens to be one where they're taking different positions, going in different directions. To talk about significant revenue losses, I think is an overstatement. You can't really lose what you never had. And if the Oregon Supreme Court were to uphold the tax court, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of everyone's expectations going in, what you would have would be a windfall for the local taxing districts in the county, as opposed to some sort of, you know, restoration of revenue. I mean, this revenue, not a penny of which has ever gone to any of these activities at the local level, and that's just a fact. So we would strongly encourage this committee to move this bill along in the process. We think that it represents good policy in the sense that you're not rewriting tax policy. What you're doing is restoring parties to the expected status quo at the time this entire endeavor was undertaken. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to try and respond to any questions that the committee may have.
Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you. Bill, regarding the enterprise zone, I'm not that familiar as to how that would work in this type of situation, but I always thought that was basically for businesses, either profit or for-profit or non-profit, but not for governmental entities. And my understanding, this facility is actually owned by the city of Cave Falls, and so it doesn't seem like they would need to basically get the benefit of being in enterprise zone as compared to a corporation that's coming into one of these established economic areas.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Prozanski, I think you're correct, and I am not as familiar with that issue as I'd like to be, but my understanding is that if the facility had been qualified under the enterprise zone statute, and the contract and the private entity involved in managing the facility had been as well, at the time that the operations began, there would have been a tax exemption. So in other words, it didn't so much matter the facility was constructed in an enterprise zone as that the option would have been there at day one to assure that the value of the contract was not taxable.
Thank you.
I have a question for you, Bill. I mean, I think your point about the enterprise zone is interesting. I mean, that definitely reflects at least a state of mind of what the thought would be of the values of the facility and the liabilities. And I know you feel that the bill has been, you know, written pretty narrowly, and that, you know, may or may not be the case. And so I'm, you know, not an attorney who can scrutinize all that those possibilities, although there seems to be some doubt about that. What is your feeling about if, in fact, as a committee, we decided to recognize that, yeah, this was an assumption, it was done on good faith, and the options that were out there clearly indicate, such as the enterprise zone exemption, property tax exemption, indicate that you would have done things differently. Would you see any value or have any heartburn over the fact that the bill was amended at all to basically reflect this particular project only, for the contract that was entered into, you know, at such and such a date? I mean, to make it very clear that it's only this and that we don't change any policy or tax policy going forward, and anyone else who engages in one of these types of operation goes in, you know, eyes wide open as to what the implications may or may not be?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Metzger, obviously, if there was a way to make it narrower than it is, we don't object to that. I mean, we're just trying to address the Klamath Falls PPM issue.
Any other questions for Mr. Linden? Okay, thank you. The chair has asked me to close this one out and open a public hearing on House Bill 3454. And let's ask Mr. John DiLorenzo and John Cameron to come forward. He's probably out checking the ball game, so we hope we'll have a score very soon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Vice Chair and Senator Metzger and members of the committee. Name is John DiLorenzo, for the record. I am a partner with the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, and I'm here on behalf of my clients, the cities of Seattle and Tacoma, Washington. Also with me is one of my law partners, Mr. John Cameron, who is the chairman of our Portland Energy Group at Davis Wright, and he is here to answer any questions that you may have. I'll make our main presentation. We are here in support today of House Bill 3454A as passed by the House without any further amendment. Both the cities of Seattle and Tacoma have municipal electric utility departments, much like the cities of Eugene and Springfield. These municipal utilities are not operated for profit. They are departments within their respective city governments, and they provide electric service to their citizens and local businesses within the cities. Seattle's electric department is called Seattle City Light. Tacoma's department is called the Department of Public Utilities Light Division, or more commonly, Tacoma Power. Neither Seattle City Light nor Tacoma Power serve any customers in Oregon whatsoever. Neither owns any physical property within the state of Oregon whatsoever. The cities of Seattle and Tacoma each own hydroelectric generating facilities, all located in Washington. The output of these hydro facilities is combined with wholesale power purchases, principally from Bonneville Power, to serve the electrical needs of their citizens in the state of Washington. As with any hydro facility, the output of the Seattle and Tacoma hydro plants varies often from hour to hour, depending on rainfall, flood control measures, and on the amounts of water that must be released to facilitate migration of salmon through affected watersheds. This natural man-made variability can swing the power supplies of Seattle and Tacoma from surplus to deficit and back to surplus over very short periods of time. Utilities in California will often purchase Northwest surplus electricity and sell electricity back during times of energy shortage in the Northwest. The California market also allows Seattle and Tacoma to balance their power supplies in Washington with the demands of their municipal customers in Washington. The balancing of supply and demand is done for the purpose of minimizing electric rates and not for making a profit. Much of this power flows over the transmission network of BPA, which owns and operates approximately 75% of the high-voltage transmission facilities in the Northwest. The BPA offers electric transmission service to every utility in the Northwest. All transmission lines connecting the Northwest to California are owned by the BPA, Portland General Electric, and PacifiCorp. These three utilities individually own a variety of alternating current transmission lines and substations that are all operated together and known as the Pacific Northwest AC Intertie. That system runs pursuant to a set of agreements between Bonneville and those utilities dating back to the mid-1960s when the intertie was first constructed. Seattle and Tacoma each have contracts with the U.S. Department of Energy for use of the intertie, but have no right to use any particular facilities. Although the Department of Revenue was aware in 1995 that Seattle and Tacoma had intertie contracts with the BPA, it did not assess Seattle and Tacoma until 2001, when it sought to retroactively assess each city back to the year 1995, claiming that this situation constituted omitted property under Oregon's omitted property statute. By including retroactive assessments, the department attempted to assess the ratepayers of Seattle and Tacoma approximately $5,600,000. Neither Seattle nor Tacoma have ever paid a dime of this tax. Instead, each has challenged the department's assessment by filing for relief in the Oregon Tax Court. The case is currently pending in the Oregon Tax Court. ORS 307090 exempts city property from property taxation. The statute has been construed to apply only to cities located in this state. The Department of Revenue is attempting to tax Seattle and Tacoma only because they are located outside of the state of Oregon. Yet to be decided by the tax court judge is our assertion that this disparate tax treatment of Oregon versus out-of-state cities constitutes unlawful discrimination under the Commerce Clause of the United States Constitution. If we prevail on this issue, then the tax court will have two basic options. Judge Breitoff could eliminate potentially the discrimination by including Seattle and Tacoma within the ambit of ORS 307.090, but in that case, he would likely have to rewrite the law, something that courts are loath to do. Or he can completely invalidate the exception as to all cities, both inside and outside of Oregon, to make the treatment equal. This has happened in prior cases where a party has taken the position that there is disparate treatment because of an exemption statute, and so the solution has been to strike the exemption statute to equalize the treatment. In other words, the tax court litigation could very well put at risk the property tax exemption now enjoyed by Oregon cities. If the tax court judge so rules, it could create a crisis for Oregon cities and for the legislature to address. Now, although the case was set for trial in April this year, the tax court, at the request of the parties, including the Department of Revenue, has postponed the trial pending the outcome of this legislation. In other words, the court and the parties are now awaiting your policy determination regarding the proper scope of ORS 307.090. a copy of the court's letter, which evidences the postponement and anticipates a report concerning what the legislature has done with this bill, is appended to the last page of my testimony. Now, House Bill 3454A will eliminate the discrimination between Oregon and out-of-state cities by exempting any tangible or intangible property, property interests, or property rights interrelated to the Pacific Northwest Intertie, as referenced in a written agreement executed between the U.S. Department of Energy and a city of any state. So it is narrowly written to apply only to the Intertie. The exemption will apply to tax years beginning on the date of the execution of the agreement. There are only five entities with these types of contracts which relate to the Intertie. House Bill 3454 is passed by the House, would not affect the tax status of any contract signatory other than Seattle and Tacoma, and I'd like to explain why that is. Two of the other entities, privately owned Power Resources Cooperative and Puget Sound Energy, Inc., are paying property taxes and are not challenging that tax before the tax court. The fifth, Snohomish Public Utility District, is a Washington public utility district currently challenging the Department of Revenue's assessment in the tax court in the same case on a number of grounds. Snohomish PUD was not included in the version we advocated in the House because the PUD is not a city. Unlike Oregon cities, Oregon's PUDs are subject to property tax in this state. That said, this legislation would not affect Snohomish's right to continue to challenge the department's assessment before the tax court. Mr. Vice Chair and members of the committee, we are aware of a number of interests who wish to propose amendments to this bill. And I would like to take just a moment to explain why we did not include them initially. However, whether they are included is obviously a policy decision that is up to you. I just wish to review historically why they were not included to begin with. We resisted efforts of the other interests to amend into the bill because we felt that the entities they represent, not because we felt that the entities they represent should be subject to tax. We didn't necessarily have an opinion on that. But because each of the amendments would have required changes to the way Oregon taxes in-state entities. The beauty of the House version is that it does not change the way any Oregon entity is currently taxed. It merely extends the same benefit to identical entities, which are cities that happen to be located outside of Oregon. Now, I have also handed out to the members of the committee a chart, and I think it's not appended to this, but I think it's also been separately passed out to you. And it's entitled Property Taxation of Entities with Contractual Rights in the Pacific Northwest Intertie, and it's based on entity location. And it shows you what the current state of the law is before adoption of this bill and what the state of the law would be after adoption of this bill. Before adoption of the bill, cities would not pay any property tax on any interest they might have in the intertie if they are located within Oregon. However, if a city is located outside of Oregon, it is the Department of Revenue's view that they should pay property tax. Likewise, privately owned owners or those with an interest in the intertie would pay tax if they were located within Oregon. They would pay tax if they were located outside Oregon. PUDs would pay tax if they were located in Oregon. They would pay tax, or the Department of Revenue says they should pay tax if they were located outside of Oregon. And cooperatives currently would pay tax if they were inside Oregon, would pay if outside. If this bill passes, all the bill does, first of all, you'll notice the bill does not change the incidence of taxation at all with respect to inside Oregon. Cities would still continue to pay no property tax if they're located in Oregon. The only change is that if you take very similar cities and they're located outside of Oregon, they would enjoy the very same tax treatment. And so this bill conforms the tax treatment of cities outside of Oregon to the current tax system within the state of Oregon. We urge your committee, and welcome back, Mr. Chairman, we urge your committee to send this bill with a do-pass recommendation to the floor for a number of reasons. And, Mr. Chairman, I am at page 5 of my written testimony. First, the nonprofit municipal light departments of Seattle and Tacoma do not utilize the Intertie as a profit center. Rather, they need the Intertie to transport power that they import in times of shortage and to find a home for surplus power in times of surplus. Secondly, the state does not impose a property tax on Oregon cities. Enactment of this legislation will correct a constitutional defect, in our view, in Oregon law by treating out-of-state cities fairly and by providing them the same tax treatment as Oregon cities would receive with respect to their contract rights pertaining to the Intertie. Number three, no local government is currently dependent upon any tax revenues generated from the cities of Seattle or Tacoma with respect to the Intertie. Neither Seattle nor Tacoma have paid Oregon property tax in the past. Passage of this bill will not generate a refund of any sort. Number four, the state of Washington does not tax intangible contract rights at all. Any such rights held by Oregon entities regarding federal transmission lines in Washington are not subject to property tax there in Washington. Number five, from time to time, state legislatures attempt to tax residents of border states in a discriminatory manner. These attempts quite often invite retaliation by the border states. This is something that Representative Butler was speaking to, his primary concern. We believe, Mr. Chairman, the passage of this bill will send a welcome signal to the state of Washington that Oregon has no intention of treating out-of-state cities in a discriminatory way. Now, the Association of Oregon Counties was opposed to this bill in the House because it could limit an opportunity for their members to generate additional revenue. They opposed the bill despite the fact that none of them have ever collected these taxes from Seattle or Tacoma, that Oregon cities would never have been assessed these taxes, that Washington does not tax intangibles at all, and that the Department of Revenue might lose in the tax court anyway. Mr. Chairman and members, our tax policy should be logically driven and non-discriminatory. Despite opposition by the counties, this bipartisan bill passed unanimously out of the House Revenue Committee and passed the full House by a vote of 48 to 10. We hope it will find bipartisan support here, too. Mr. Chairman, I thank you and the members of your committee for your interest in this issue. Mr. Cameron and I are available to answer any questions that you may have about the bill.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. DiLorenzo. And, Mr. Cameron, you've testified already or just here?
Mr. Chairman, he is not. He's my resource here and yours.
Wingman today, Mr. Chairman.
Wingman.
And yours.
And ours. Questions or thoughts for Mr. DiLorenzo? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time. And if you could be available for the remainder of this hearing, we might ask for you to give you an opportunity to speak at the end if you choose.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Gary Conkling. Gary, I'm just going to let you, since you have a singular interest, testify, and then we'll bring up Sandy Flicker and Scott Corwin. Scott, you've been quoted quite a bit recently on this court case, I've noticed. Good to see you. Gary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Gary Conkling, appearing here today on behalf of Snohomish Public Utility District. I have prepared testimony which lays out a little bit of background about Snohomish PUD, the transmission agreements that have been referenced, and then also some of the issues. But I'm going to just testify briefly today to try to highlight a couple of the key points. I think Mr. DiLorenzo did a good job in outlining the case and noting that there is a third plaintiff in tax court, which is Snohomish County PUD. And like Seattle and Tacoma, in its home state, Snohomish PUD is a municipal corporation. That's how we're organized. And I think it's interesting that notwithstanding how customer-owned utilities are variously taxed in Oregon, the Department of Revenue, in moving against these three utilities, moved against them in unison. It did not differentiate Seattle City Light and Tacoma Power from Snohomish PUD. They are asserting the same property interest for all three. Mr. DiLorenzo noted that Seattle and Tacoma do not have a physical presence, customers, or power generating facilities in Oregon. Neither does Snohomish County PUD. It provides electric and other related services that are allowed under the state of Washington for its customers that are basically in Everett in the surrounding area in Snohomish County, which is north of Seattle. As Mr. DiLorenzo noted, there are only a handful of utilities that entered into a very unique arrangement. It's a one-of-a-kind arrangement that was designed to help finance an additional capacity for the interstate, for the intertie transmission line. These agreements are the result of the financial transaction that went in to help the financing. But as a result of those agreements, we do not have any normal ownership rights or privileges for the intertie, which is a federal facility in itself, not subject to tax in Oregon. We can't decide how to use it or when to use it. The Department of Energy and the Bonneville Power Administration would get real itchy if we attempted to. One of the points that we contend and why we have offered the Dash 3 amendment to House Bill 3454 is that cities or municipal corporations should be treated equally, and we've included the ones that are actually being assessed. As it turns out, the three people who are contesting the case in front of the Oregon Tax Court are Seattle, Tacoma, and Snohomish, and therefore we think it's appropriate for House Bill 3454 to make a policy statement about all three. It would seem awkward if, in fact, Seattle and Tacoma were exempted, and Snohomish, which is like it back in its own home state, was left in tax court arguing the case. We would have no choice but to argue unequal treatment. And many of the concerns that Mr. DiLorenzo expressed about a potential outcome that could challenge the status of Oregon municipal utility taxation in Oregon would be in play almost on purpose as a result of essentially leaving us out of this particular bill. We also contend, frankly, and the core point of our case is that there's really the policy question here is one of nexus. Does it make sense for Oregon to apply a property tax to the ratepayers in Tacoma, Seattle, and Everett when they have no customers here, no business here, no physical presence here, and aren't generating power here? That's really the question that I think that the case popped its way across the street over here to help decide. I think the Department of Revenue has a right to assert what it's doing. We're not here to make any accusations about the department. It's doing a fine job. We just disagree with this particular decision. In our particular case, relationship with respect to the intertie involves a firm power transaction for power generated outside of Everett that's sold to customers in Sacramento. That contract was entered into some time ago on the expectation that we were not subject to Oregon property tax, I think a reasonable expectation at that time. We do not have the ability to go ask Sacramento to change its schedule. So this is essentially going to be a property tax that will be applied to our ratepayers in Everett and the surrounding county. We have no ability to recapture the money. Now, the money is not huge. In our case, it is less than $100,000 per year. And as Mr. DiLorenzo noted, Seattle and Tacoma have one fact difference from us, and that is we inadvertently or mistakenly, if you will, paid Oregon property tax one year because an administrative person just thought it was a bill and went ahead and wrote the check. We're not, through the Dash 3 amendment, seeking any refund of that amount of money. That's our mistake, our problem. But we are asking to be treated equally with Seattle and Tacoma and be added to House Bill 3454. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So are you, I guess, is it Snohomish's position that if nothing passes and this just moves on to the tax court, that that is a fine outcome for this legislative session?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do support House Bill 3454 with the addition of the Dash 3 amendment. We think that that's probably the best outcome.
Uh-huh. And if the dash threes are not included, then what would Snohomish's position be?
Well, I don't know that it matters, Mr. Chair, what our position would be, but what the consequence of that would be is that we would be left in tax court as the only remaining plaintiff with little option but to argue that we were being treated unequally in Oregon on the basis of this property tax, and essentially raising, I think, some of the questions that Mr. DiLorenzo raised in his testimony.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the other thing, and I mean, you mentioned retroactive, is there is somewhat of a retroactive nature to the original bill, and whether put the dash three in for Snohomish or not. You probably know, we're always reticent to involve ourselves in cases that are pending, and I understand that maybe this isn't completely pending, but would be absent any action by this committee, and anything that feels retroactive. Could have put this question to John, but...
Right. Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that the retroactivity comes from the fact that these agreements had been entered into and been in effect for some time before the department made its assessment against these utilities. So the reaching back actually is a function of the department's assessment, and we're just attempting to try to address that particular situation. The reality is that, as Mr. DiLorenzo stated, nobody, with the exception of my utility, inadvertently one year, has paid any of this money. It's not in escrow in any account. It hasn't been paid at all.
Just a bill sitting on a desk.
Right.
In a case.
Senator Dorch.
Kerry, I hope you have the answer to this. And if not, if someone else out there has it, it would be greatly appreciated to get an answer to it. My understanding of this AC intertie from the very beginning was that it's just like a gigantic pot, and everybody's adding into that pot or that lake, and everybody's taken out of it at any given time. And so is it really possible to identify whether your electrons got down to Sacramento or whether Sacramento's got back to you at some time in there? And so therefore, is it even possible, is maybe that's why the federal government structured it that way, to even identify something in which you could say you taxed it? Because you put it into the big conduit, which is flowing both directions. It's a big pot of energy that's being distributed minute by minute, second by second, probably. And therefore, is it possible to even tax it?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I think you raise a good point that tracking physical electrons moving from one plant to a destination is probably not anything that anybody does, because that's probably not what physically actually happens. This is a facilitation device, a mechanism, again, as was described, that helps utilities in the Pacific Northwest and in California adjust to seasonal changes or other variations in power supply for the benefit of their ratepayers. And Snohomish County PUD, as a customer-owned utility, which generates no profit, it does the same as Seattle City Light and Tacoma Power, which is to look after the benefit of its ratepayers by giving them the lowest prices possible for power. And this is one way to do it.
Mr. Chairman, just kind of a point of information for everyone. In California, way back when we studied this process, there are facilities in the Central Valley and the Sierra Nevadas that, in fact, generate electricity during the peak hours, and then when power is cheap from other sources, actually buy the power, pump the water back up into the upper lake, and generate it on demand when it's needed. Now, can you imagine if we tax the power they generated as it headed north to Oregon, and then we tax the power going back to lift that water back up into that facility? I mean, these are significant decisions we're making that may, in fact, affect a system that functions very well right now. And I'm a little bit concerned about that, because I know for a fact they bought power if they could. If it was cheap enough to pump back, they pumped back. And so the effect of that was that it was profitable to do that, because of the fact that you were generating a high dollar at a time of the day, high dollar power, you know, as it went through the facility, and then when power was cheap in those off hours, you pumped it back. So I would hope that, you know, there may be more significance to this, or maybe I just got it completely out of balance. But I think it's a complex system that ought to be left alone. And one of those factors is I don't think you can identify where those electrons are.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator George, I think that's correct. And I think your general appreciation that it's a complex network and getting more complex by the day as we look at different kinds of generating resources. I think it is a bit ironic in this bill that our customer in California happens to be a municipal utility district, just as sort of an interesting little aside, that operates nuclear power generating facilities. And so part of what is being traded here is something that has essentially a different kind of an approach to it that can be balanced off with the hydroelectric resources, which many utilities, particularly customer-owned utilities in the Northwest, rely upon.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gary, and listening to your testimony and then looking at Mr. DiLorenzo's chart, and I don't know if you've had a chance to see the before and after chart.
I'm familiar with it.
Who's getting taxed at different times. I guess the question I have is regarding on the PUD. When you look at the ones that are in-state, Oregon, they pay currently the PUD. They pay the tax as a PUD. What I'm hearing in your argument is that you want us to basically take the definition of a sister state, this case Washington, how they define PUDs as municipal, and putting them kind of like animals, and treating them on that basis instead of treating the Washington state PUDs similar to what we have already built in for Oregon PUDs. And I've got some difficulty as to making that comparison and making that distinction, because then it's basically Oregon can't rely on its own structure, and it must then start looking at other states, how they define their entities that are based within their state.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Prezansky, Oregon's tax statutes refer to people's utility districts. Snohomish is a public utility district. Maybe a nuance of the difference, maybe not. But we are what we are in our home state. We're organized under Washington statute as a public utility district and in the form as a municipal corporation, no more, no less. This bill is written very, very narrowly to apply only to the property rights and interests associated with the intertie. As it turns out, there are no and will probably never be any Oregon People's Utility Districts that have such rights. Subsequent to entering into this agreement to help expand the capacity of the intertie, federal policy changed, and access to the intertie is now easier to affect for all utilities. So it is very unlikely that any subsequent agreement between any utilities, whether they're in-state, out-of-state, customer-owned, or investor-owned, is likely to be entered into. So I think this is a very unique circumstance, and I appreciate the point you're making. But I don't really think the argument before the Oregon legislature is about how we tax Oregon customer-owned utilities. The Department of Revenue apparently didn't think so either, because it actually went after all three of these utilities with really the same assessment. And I think that the answer ought to be that they ought to be treated the same.
If I follow up,
please.
I guess there's a similarity, though, when we look at criminal law and convictions. One of the things that we do in our laws, we will look at other states and not look to see how they identify or title a crime, but what are the elements of those crimes. And for someone to have an enhanced penalty or have a requirement to perform some task if they're coming into the state that has been convicted in another state, they'll actually look at the elements that are making up those crimes. And to me, it seems there's some similarities there. The other thing, I guess, is this part about not knowing which neutrons or whose neutrons when they're going down the line. Can you tell us about gasoline pipelines? I mean, my understanding, you have a set of pipelines that are used to push gas through the pipeline that's going to be metered or certain time, and they could be running from Washington State, where there's a refinery, through Oregon and into California or someplace else.
Mr. Chair, Senator Prezansky asked to the first question relative to similar crimes. I think Mr. DiLorenzo noted that these interests, if they were in Washington, would not be subject to tax. And I think maybe that is the most relevant out-of-state fact, is that in our own home state, they're not subject to tax.
But in Oregon, they are. In Washington State, they wouldn't be.
If an Oregon utility, if I may, Mr. Chair, Senator Prezansky, though, had a similar interest in the state of Washington, it wouldn't be taxed. I think that's the point I'm trying to make.
Okay.
As to natural gas pipelines, some gas originates in Washington, but most of it is actually coming out of either Alaska or Canada. In those particular cases, there again, gas can be added or taken out of those lines at various points. In fact, there are stations where that's purposely done. As I think you're aware, I represent, unrelated to this matter, TransCanada, which is one of the two major natural gas pipeline owners in this state, and it it has physical presence in this state and a number of facilities related to its pipeline, all of which, by the way, happen to be subject to property tax. Again, the gas situation is that you don't really follow the exact part of gas that goes through a line either. You're dealing in volumes.
Right.
Thank you. Sure. Jerry, I think we need to draw that distinction clearly that if, in fact, Shinomish Power had facilities, physical facilities here, they'd be taxed. Correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I believe that that's true. If we operated a power plant in Oregon, for example, my presumption is that it would be subject to Oregon property taxation, and we would be under the central assessment like other utilities in the state.
But this bill doesn't deal with that at all. It deals with the Pacific Northwest AC intertie and whether we're going to tax those transmissions.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, that's correct.
Okay, I want to make that... get that division clear with us, if we could. Is that correct? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I failed to say one thing. Nobody so far has actually welcomed Senator Starr back, and I personally am really glad to see him. And I'm sorry if that sounds sort of just coming out of the blue, but it's nice to see him here. I hadn't expected to see him here today. So
he's actually on the floor with us, too.
Good.
And we did welcome again. It's a nice ploy for one vote on your amendment.
No. I'm not that good of a lobbyist, Mr. Chair, but he's been a longtime friend, and I'm very glad to see him.
Yeah, surprising how quick. I think I was shocked when Bruce told me he was going to be here today. Thank you.
Thank you.
He gets the Tough Bird Award.
Yeah. Bruce said that he walked his whole farm or walked out to the blueberries over the weekend, which just surprised me even more. Ms. Flicker, Mr. Corwin,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the most important question is the ball game over?
Well, I don't know if it's over. We don't want it to be.
Okay. Well, it's a little hard competing with a championship baseball game going on. For the record, my name is Sandy Flicker, and I am I'm here to represent the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. With me today is Mr. Scott Corwin, who is Vice President of Marketing and Public Affairs for the Pacific Northwest Generating Co-op, and he is clearly my expert that is here today. However, I would like to make just a couple of brief comments. We're here today in support of the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3454, and just to make it very clear, those amendments are actually all-inclusive. They would include both in-state and out-of-state PUDs and in-state and out-of-state electric cooperatives. I wanted to just mention briefly that Representative Butler made a comment about this bill being about equity. And I think we couldn't agree with him more that there are certainly issues at hand that have a lot to do with equity among utilities. I think Senator George nailed the true issue about who pays. And also I wanted to reflect on some of Mr. DiLorenzo's testimony, which he mentioned that this issue is about establishing a tax policy that should be locally driven and non-discriminatory. And I think we couldn't agree with that more as well, that as you approach this very difficult issue that you've had two today of, that we would hope that you would think about equity and you would think about Senator George's, how Senator George captured this issue. that's really what we're asking you to do. I also want to make sure you clearly understand that electric cooperatives are also not-for-profit utilities. We serve primarily rural areas, and also the electric cooperatives that pay this tax on this intertie are located in Washington, in Idaho, and in Wyoming, as well as in Oregon. So we have exactly the same interest as the previous testifier, Mr. Conklin. So with that, I'm going to let Mr. Corwin give you the expert testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, I'm Scott Corwin, here today representing a group of rural electric cooperatives, collectively known as Power Resources Cooperative. It includes six of the Oregon Rural Electric Co-ops, two in the Eugene area, Consumers Power in Blatchley Lane, Douglas down in Roseburg, Umatilla out in Hermiston, Coos Curry down in Port Orford, Central Electric in Redmond. But it also includes three Idaho cooperatives, one in Washington State and one in Wyoming. Just to focus back on the bill, House Bill 3454 does focus on exempting the taxes relating to the intertie. Now, the interest in the intertie for these entities, for all that have testified today, is limited to a right to schedule and obtain transmission service from the wholesale supplier, in this case, Bonneville Power. It is a high voltage transmission system that runs between Oregon and California, and only this Oregon portion has become subject to taxation, or at least in this case, litigation over taxation. The House bill only exempts cities as passed, but it's drafted to center on that specific issue of transmission scheduling rights. But there's an equally persuasive reason for exempting other not-for-profit utilities who hold identical rights. Why should it be amended to exempt cooperatives' rights to the intertie? Well, to the extent there is some underlying policy concern regarding taxation of out-of-state entities, PRC is certainly a group that includes these cooperatives headquartered in Washington, Idaho, Wyoming, and Oregon. The consumers of those cooperatives hold the liability for that tax. They are, especially those out-of-state entities, are like the other entities that have testified already. They own no assets here in Oregon. They have no customers in Oregon. But this is not just an interstate tax issue. The bill in its language, if you read it, clearly addresses a property tax question, and it's specific to one intangible asset. Not-for-profit electric cooperatives have been paying taxes relating to their identical intertie rights because of an earlier Oregon tax court ruling. But even that court acknowledged the obscure nature of the property in question, which are scheduling rights to transmission capacity. In fact, the court said, and I quote, "These issues become more difficult when dealing with abstract properties such as this." It even noted, and I quote again, "The law may need to adjust at some point to these new challenges." That's why we're here today. We didn't get our ruling put on hold. The case proceeded ahead, and we've been paying that. However, as the chair noted, if you're reticent to be involved in pending cases, this one has been settled, and we would urge that there's a policy question here. Not a new policy, but a correction to the way we viewed the law already clearly indicated that we should not be taxed on this. So the time to exempt the taxation of these contracts is now, because these transmission contracts should not have been taxed in the first place. The property here is a transmission facility clearly owned and maintained by the Bonneville Power Administration. Cooperatives only have an ability to ask Bonneville for scheduling capacity. These co-ops collectively only have 50 megawatts of potential capacity out of 4,800 megawatts on the AC intertie. They don't hold the property. They don't have exclusive use of the property, as is the test on when you can tax federal property. There's a small impact of these co-ops in general on the intertie. The state is unable to tax the actual owner, who is the Department of Energy. So it seeks to recover those from those who merely pay to use the transmission line. In our case, those people are cooperatives who, by law, pay or actually buy and sell power at cost to some of the Northwest's smallest towns and rural, sparsely populated areas. We think that this tax also violates the Supremacy Clause of the United States Constitution. We raised that argument in court. Actually, the other parties here today similarly raised that argument in the cases they have pending, because it imposes a tax on a non-possessory interest in the property of the United States. That's why ORS 307060 clearly outlines when you can tax property that is owned by the federal government. It's only in specific instances that should not apply in this case. It violates the doctrine of intergovernmental tax immunity, which forbids taxation of one sovereign by another, as well as indirect taxes that discriminate against those with whom the sovereign deals. You have an opportunity as a legislature to correct this policy on behalf of those who use the AC intertie to move electricity to consumers, but this policy should apply to all consumer-owned entities, whether they're in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, or Wyoming. That's what the Dash 2 amendments do. They have minimal incremental impact, as you can see by the revenue impact, because we, our group collectively also pays somewhere between $50,000 and $100,000 annually on those taxes. I'd say on the question that that you posed regarding Mr. DiLorenzo's testimony, why would these entities be kept out of the bill, I would have drafted his chart slightly differently, and it goes to an observation that Senator George made. I would have made a chart that showed the intertie and how it's taxed in each state. And for California, it would have been no, no, no for each one of those entities. In Oregon, it's yes, and maybe yes, depending upon what the tax court does, and maybe yes. I think you have an opportunity to clarify that between those two states for this specific asset.
Ms. Corrin, can you tell us about the other states, too? What other states that are on that intertie, how they tax?
Yeah, well, the yes, Senator, the intertie, the part of the intertie in question is really just Oregon to California. And specifically, there was an expansion done in the mid-90s that was about half of that, a little over half of that, 4,800 megawatts of capacity that goes between Oregon and California. So you, here you have Oregon taxing, California not taxing.
But isn't Washington State and Idaho somehow tied into this? I thought I heard that those are some of the entities that are actually pushing stuff through. So can you tell us how they tax?
Yeah, well, and they, I mean, they don't have the same asset. As far as how they tax intangibles, we don't, we have never had an issue come up with either state. So, yeah, so they don't, they do not.
Thank you.
So I'd say, you know, because the bill changes the way one intangible is taxed, that's been our focus. Co-ops would continue to pay all other taxes. So the assertion that you're changing the tax status of either a co-op or a municipal corporation or a PUD by treatment of this one asset just isn't true. The bill clearly focuses on a property tax question for one asset. You're not changing the status across the board for anybody. In fact, you're not changing it for cities either. They decide to own other assets. Maybe they won't, but who knows, in the future you will not have changed their tax status in that regard. I think that's about all I have for now, but I'm happy to answer any questions, and I thank you very much for the opportunity to be heard today. We appreciate your time and attention, and we urge the passage of the Dash 2 amendments to treat everyone similarly.
Thank you. Senator Shaw.
I appreciate testimony. We're taxing intangible property. And with that tax, what services are being provided by the receiving unit for taxes received?
In theory, one would think the property are the transmission facilities that pass through the state of Oregon. It's owned by the Bonneville Power Administration, and I guess in that sense, the state of Oregon is providing services with property tax revenues as it does with respect to any other property that it would tax. Here, though, of course, these entities don't own those facilities. They did not site those facilities. They have no rights to physically visit or work on those facilities. So I can't name any services that Fall River Electric in rural Idaho is receiving for paying this tax.
Another question, Mr.
Please,
Chair.
Please.
The maintenance of the system, do the users of the system pay Bonneville some fee to maintain that system so it's usable and continues to transmit the power?
Yeah, part of the deal on being able to use and schedule this capacity was a maintenance, chipping in for maintenance costs also. Yes.
Mr. Chair,
please.
Seems to me that if there's a tax due and you're only using Bonneville's facilities, they should be liable for the tax as you're paying the service fee to help to maintain the system, aside from the fact now they're looking to you to come directly to you to pay a tax on that. Seems like pretty unjust sort of taxation to me.
Mr. Chair and Senator Starr, just I might add that the rates that are charged for electricity for the customers of rural electric cooperatives do include both the cost of power and the cost of transmission. So rural electric customers are all consumer-owned utility customers that are customers of Bonneville do pay for maintenance, building and maintenance of that transmission system through their electricity rates. In addition, we're now being asked to pay taxes in those rates as well for the use of these lines.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Does Bonneville pay a tax for those installations that they have on the land through the state of Oregon?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, my understanding is they do not. That is part of the statute that's relatively clear with respect to federal property. And in our opinion, that's exactly why the Department of Revenue sought to pursue these other taxpayers. In fact, that's why we brought up in our case before the tax court that we felt that was overreaching and in violation not only of that Oregon statute, but of that federal law and case law, for that matter, that forbids that, reaching through the federal government into the people that use those facilities.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I appreciate that testimony. That pretty well persuades me that we need to move the dash two amendments and move this bill forward.
Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, I think also that's such an important point because the federal government controls that line and it controls the air above Oregon. And we wouldn't think about charging somebody for a seat ride out of Olympia down to Sacramento. It was an airliner that originated there and ended up down there because it's federal airspace and this is federal property. And to me, it's just outside of our ability to tax it. I think it's pretty clever, that we've come up with these ingenious ideas in order to achieve revenue. I just don't think it's fair revenue.
Wait till we get both houses, Senator George. And then.
I know. We'll be back, though.
Senator Pazansky.
Actually, I think, Senator George, I think the airspace belongs to Oregon.
Get that drafted, Senator. Other questions or comments? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Paul, any update on where we're at in the game here? It was not looking good, but Senator Massaker's absence actually
is good.
It's a good sign. That's a good sign. They've turned around.
For multiple reasons.
Mr. Dow, Mr. Phillips, Ms. Steister, our final three on HBA 3454.
Hopefully the good senator has his rally cap on.
Well, they were down by one in the top of the tenth.
Right.
When he left.
Right.
So that's true. It's a good sign probably. They're rallying. Whatever order you would choose.
Well, maybe it makes sense to have John start, actually.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And my name is John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. Thank you for the compliment, Senator George. We're ingenious.
It's ingenious.
I wrote this down, clever and ingenious.
Mr. Chair, can I comment?
That. Please.
I just thought it was fascinating in the testimony by one of the testimonies here that they noted. Here it is, DeLorenzo's testimony. And back here he noted that in fact that we had exempted cities that we figured out a way to tax in order to provide the tax on them. But in essence, you got both of them. And I thought that was pretty clever. In other words, you got Klamath Falls, and then you also got those folks up in Washington. So
that's an interesting perspective. Thank you, Senator George. Thank you. And I would like to pass the compliment on to you because we're trying to administer your law. So I hope we're on track. If you want to change that direction, you know, this is your opportunity. So I appreciate the
be there for you.
A chance, yes. Thank you. Something to wake us up at 3:20 in the afternoon. Again, John Phillips, Department of Revenue. We believe that this bill merely extends to the same benefits to municipalities of other states that are extended to municipalities of this state. And if that's your policy choice, feel free to do that. The department is neutral on that issue. I want to clarify something Mr. DiLorenzo said, and I was getting set to do that. He mentioned something about intangible property again, and there's that word again. Every time you hear intangible property, then you think, oh, my goodness, we're doing this terrible thing. But he also said, and to his credit, Mr. DiLorenzo made a correct statement in that he said many, but this one that caught my attention, the contract gives rise to the use of the property by Seattle and Tacoma. True. The contract gives rise to the use of property, and as I said before in earlier testimony on the other bill, it's the use of the property. It's not contract. It's not intangible. It's power lines, transmission grid, substations. All of that is being used by those entities and it's the contract that gives rise to that. And that's been our argument in court. And I'm not, like I said, I'm not trying to litigate the case here. I just want to clarify that point. So, other than that, I think that the challenges that you've mentioned, ascertaining who's using the property, identifying these electrons, and all of this is challenging because of the new technology and the new arrangements. We're trying to apply your law to these situations. And I do want to make one final point, and that is in the statute itself. Several comments were made about the department deciding to tax or the department going out and reaching or overreaching again. It is in 307090. It explicitly says all property of the state, public and used for corporate purposes or intended for corporate purposes by the cities, towns, school districts, etc., and municipal corporations in this state is exempt from taxation. It says in this state. So it clearly, in our opinion, clearly these out-of-state municipalities do not constitute municipalities in this state. Feel free to change that. I'm just saying we're just trying to pursue what we think your policy is, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So, Mr. Phillips, how did you arrive at the assessment point through the department? What precipitated the decision that we have a taxable event here? Let's send our assessor out and do our work and find out what the bill would be.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's a very good question. It's to imagine, to look at a power line and a substation or a tower, you know, we would look at that and say, that looks like Bonneville's equipment. We wouldn't have any idea who uses that equipment by looking at it. And we are not privy, nor are we invited to participate in the negotiations to write up these power purchase agreements. We're not in that at all. What we did notice years ago, that one entity reported a substantially different amount of assets one year than the next. And we said to ourselves, this looks interesting. I wonder what this difference is year to year. We contacted the entity, and it turned out that they were reporting the use of the property in the intertie. And that was our first awareness that these agreements were even in existence. Bonneville does not share these agreements with us. The entity shared them at our request, I believe, and we had to do a lot of asking questions and finding out, okay, who else might have such an agreement, and that just started the ball rolling. It's been said that this case that we pursued, the initial case, was a case of first impression, and we thought, this is an interesting, complex appraisal of application of the law, not outside the limits of the law, but our theory was that in this case we had property, it's being used. It's being used by a taxable entity, and so we value the property. That instituted a case. Our assessment was challenged, and then that worked its way through the courts, I believe through the Supreme Court, and then we said this is something that Oregon courts agree with, and we assessed the rest of the entities.
So I'm just reeling back on that. So you see assets, municipalities or public utility districts files, you see assets that weren't there previously.
In this case, that, Mr. Chair, is how we
so this
learned
is a nice
of this.
Question. Why are they filing with the Oregon Department of Revenue in the first place?
In that particular instance, that was an entity that had other taxable assets. It wasn't a municipality. It was, I believe it was the predecessor to Power Resources Corporation.
So they had other activity in Oregon that was...
I believe that's correct. Or we would have perhaps never known.
Huh.
Yeah, it's just like downstairs. Like I said, you see 79 spaces, and you think, that must be non-taxable public property. But somehow somebody asked the question, and or the capital administrative staff filed a return, and that's how the county assessor knows.
So are you? Well, I guess you are, because you have access now to all the information. You're sure that at least when you did this initial round of assessment, that you hit all the folks that are on the intertie that would be germane to. To this.
Mr. Chair, I believe so. There's not. Please, anybody can speak up.
I'm sure they will. They're sitting in here. They're not going to say a word. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It would occur to me, and it's just a farmer thing, that if the federal government wouldn't give you the information, that my assumption would be then is when they could envision this whole intertie system and all this power generation for all of the, let's say, 6 or 8 western states, that they had assumed that we would not be coming in to tax it. Or if they had, they would have provided for you that information, which they did not do, and you had to go backwards and get it from the actual people utilizing the system who are signing up to utilize transmission area.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I'm not sure they're under any obligation to share any of that information with us, and there may be even confidentiality restrictions on them sharing that, even if they were willing and thought we might be using it. So,
other questions? Okay, Gil and Michelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. This is, as John said, another issue of the use of public property by property tax exempt entities. It's gotten very complicated, this conversation. I'm going to make it a little bit more complicated. I'd like you to understand that 307090 is not uncommon in other states. In other words, Washington State, if an Oregon city owns or uses property in Washington State, that would be taxed if it was owned or used by a private entity. Washington State will tax that Oregon city. So this is...
I'm sorry, Gil. So I've wondered on that. So if we were sitting in Olympia right now, and since we don't have as many public utilities, but we have, customer-owned, and so is EWEB. So say we were sitting in Olympia, same intertie arrangement,
Would EWEB then be taxed based on Washington statutes?
You know, Mr. Chair, I have to. What I did was on the original bill, I contacted Washington Department of Revenue, posed the question, the context of the original bill, which a city in Oregon owns or uses property in Washington State, otherwise would be property taxable by a private entity in Washington State. Is that city in Oregon taxed? And the answer was yes, it's taxed. In other words, they have a parallel statute that we have, and I understand it's fairly common in other states.
Okay.
So this exemption, there's a specific exemption in Washington State statute much like this for their cities and so on, and it only applies to in-state cities and municipalities. Now, to the extent it applies to EWEB and others, I'd have to go back and get that. The cities of Seattle and Tacoma have capacity ownership interest in the intertie, as you know. They transmit this energy through Oregon to the state of California for sale. There's no Oregon municipality who holds this type of capacity ownership that we're aware of. You need not and should not give a competitive advantage to the cities of Washington State conducting business enterprises and marketing their power and sending it to California. They can absorb whatever modest tax load we have in our cut and capped property tax system. The amount of money in play for Seattle City Light is $3 million. For Tacoma Power, it's nearly $900,000. The major recipient of these revenues is education. We've heard comments in the House about possible retribution, but I've not heard any expressed or implied, other than from a proponent. In the House, proponents characterized local government opposition as being driven by an insatiable thirst for revenue. And again, I remind you that AOC supports Senate Bill 479, the property tax exemption for primary agricultural food processors. So I believe we've demonstrated how unjustified that characterization is. We would ask that that you let current law stand, let the tax court work through this, and slow down a little bit. It's gotten very complex. You need to understand that there is a lot of potential here and unintended consequences. So we just ask for a little patience and take some time for reflection. Thank you.
Senator George, did you have?
No, I was just holding up my hand. Yes, I'm one who believes there could be retaliation. So I think I said that the first time this was heard. I think that is a major implication. If I was Washington State and as many things as I shipped down through here, I'd start taxing it. You'd all be paying it. So I think that's a legitimate issue that we need to consider.
Thank you. Other thoughts or questions?
Good heavens. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michelle Deister with the League of Oregon Cities. Everybody seems to have an opinion on this bill, and we, of course, are no exception. I'm here today to speak in opposition to the A2 and the A3 amendments to House Bill 3454A. Because these amendments convey an exemption to entities that currently pay property tax in Oregon. If we were to look down the road, we have reservations about any legislation that could be used at some point down the road to justify these entities being exempt from property taxes in other instances.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Ask her what happened. Give us heart back to your day.
It's a sad day in Beantown. Beavers lost 4-3 in 10 innings. But it was a good season.
Good season for them. We had a really good
season.
Yeah. Made the final eight. Okay. Closed public hearing on House Bill 3454. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 415, and there's Steve. Steve, sorry to, was wondering if we kept you. While Steve gets settled, committee, I'll give you the background on this. I was, and Steve can give you what's in the bill. The Ways and Means folks, or the Senate Ways and Means budget, I guess now, came and said, we need $22 to $24 additional million dollars to help close out our school funding, and is there a way to do it within the ESD framework by cutting the formula of what is now 95.5 by 0.25%, which gets you the in the ballpark of the right figure. And so that's where you have this bill before us today, is that it does. It cuts by 0.25% down from 5% to 4.75, and so the remaining would go to school districts across the state. And then it requires, well, Steve, I'll let you go into what the bill is, but that's kind of the background of how you have this before you this afternoon.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 415-2 is the amendment that you should have before you. And it does replace the bill, so there's nothing left in the original bill, just what's in the amendment. And it does increase the school district share of state and local revenue from 95% to 95.25%. And then to compensate, the share of the ESDs would drop from 5% to 4.75%. And the 95.5 would first take effect in 05-06. So that's the fifth year of the phase-in of ESD equalization. So it's, so we don't have that 95.5 split yet, but it would start in 05-06. It also changes the ESD minimum amount of revenue that will be in effect in 05-06 from $1 million to $950,000. So that affects about five ESDs. Then the other aspect of the bill deals with administrative costs. It says that ESDs will calculate their revenue both at the 5% level and at the 4.75% level, look at that difference, take half of that difference, and then reduce their 04-05 administrative costs by half of that amount, and that would be the maximum administrative cost that they could then have in 05-06. And it, the on the revenue side of it, it would shift about $9.6 million in the first year from ESDs to school districts and about $10 million in the second. And I do have one page of numbers for you that shows it, the estimated effects by ESD.
Okay. I know Ozzy and Conkling want to speak in opposition to this. Anyone else want to talk about Bill and what we're doing?
Sure.
Yeah, please.
Before we get going, I was wondering if Steve could walk us through. I see this sheet that you did on the run for that cost, the impact on ESD financing. Was there any run done as to taking that money and then putting it into the actual school districts?
I did not do that. It's $15 per weighted student, and I think you have other runs probably with the weighted students, but I can do that if you like.
Well, I mean, basically, are we just shifting the money from the ESD and it's going to go into the school districts?
Yes.
That are within that county, pretty much? Or
all school districts.
Yeah.
But there's no slippage in the dollars. They go from one directly into the state's school districts across the state. Correct?
Yes.
Other questions for Steve before we get to our testimony? Yes, Senator George.
I'm sorry, I stepped out. Based on that question, are you telling me that if a board decided that they wanted to remove that ESD part, that would go back into the state and wouldn't remain in their district? That another, the amount of money that would have been there for ESD?
The Dash 2 amendment is what we're looking at.
Okay.
And that just says we'll distribute less state school fund dollars to ESDs and distribute more state school fund dollars to school districts.
Oh, okay.
Same amount, both
ways. So it's changing the direction of the option of the district. Okay.
And what we say, half of the cut should come from administrative
costs of ESD, yes.
Of the ESD. Okay. Any other questions for Steve? Ozzy? Yeah, there you are. And Gary, do you want to come up? I know you don't like this bill either.
My client.
Your client doesn't like it. Well, some of them should, but some of them. Light blue shirt day. Mr. Rouse.
Ms. Chair, for the record, I'm Ozzie Rose. I reside at 1323 Jordan Drive South, and I'm representing the Oregon Association of ESDs. And with all due respect, do I make my plug for sucking up to Senator Starr now, or do I let the original thing go?
Your partner here will do it for you. He's on the same side of this as you are, so you benefit.
Excuse me. It was sincere.
Mr. Chair, we oppose the proposal in the S2 amendments, and the bill does move about $20 million for the biennium, 9 plus the first year and 10 plus the second year, from the portion of the state school fund that goes to ESDs to the portion that goes to school districts. It's about $15 a kid. The formula, the 95-5 split, is the last, or was the last part of the mechanism put together to create equity in our school funding. It started in the early 90s, and you're familiar with that. And the decision to do the 95-5 was part of that decision. What this does is move a port, change the percentage to 95 and a quarter of 4.75. But the 90% of the change, the $20 million, 90% of it is already in the resolution services being spent in a way local districts have asked that it be spent. So the cut, if you make this cut or make this change, the cut to the ESDs will be a cut in services that they can provide, and the districts will have to either get those services in some other manner or create a way to get them. And the impact of this, over half of our school districts have fewer than 1,000 kids. And so those districts are going to pick up $15 a kid, or less than $15,000. And in some cases, they're not going to be able to buy or create the service that they're currently getting through the ESD. There are reasons to talk about ESDs. I know we're not in that right now, but this particular small move, I don't think is appropriate at this time, especially this time in the budget making process, and especially because it isn't designed to make anything specific happen except to assert that we have more money in local schools now than we did have. The shift will be different. The impact will be different in every ESD, and none of us know exactly how it will impact individuals. Two ESDs, I know, currently give the local districts through the resolution process more than 100% of the money you give ESDs now. So it's all over the map on what goes on out there. And this particular move isn't aimed at any particular mission in our view. And if you're going to change the funding patterns, we need to do it in a thoughtful way that looks forward, and we have some idea of what the impact will be district by district and ESD by ESD. And we don't think this does it. It doesn't look like a lot of money, but it'll be a lot of money in some cases. And I believe that one generalization you can make is the smaller the ESD and the smaller school district, the bigger the impact will be, a negative impact. With that, I'll... by the way, both COSA and OSBA, who represent local school districts, do not support this measure. You would think that this is a kind of a ESD versus local school districts, and it is not. It is not. And with that, I'll be quiet and answer questions if you have any. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Ozzie. So, Ozzie, the one thing that when we were discussing this... that at least to me I found appealing is, and I would never argue that you're creating new resources for K through 12 or that you found this new set of money, but I know, and it's more anecdotal by nature, but that if you look at school districts, especially the ones I'm familiar with, and you watch, and maybe I'm just more familiar with them, the cuts that they've made, and then I view the ESDs that I'm familiar with, I don't believe they've gone through. I'll just say it very bluntly. I don't think they've gone through the cuts, the tough cuts that school districts, now everyone's been in a tough environment, but had to make those tough. And so that I do find appeal in that one realm, is that this would, because of the way it's drafted, at least have some partial benefit to schools and ask ESDs to make some administrative cuts that obviously are difficult, but at least I believe there could be some there.
Mr. Chair. Specifically the Northwest, that's yours. The Northwest was an equalization district, and we spent 5 years trying to get the equity things written out. Now, under this bill, next year, by that last portion of the bill, Northwest, you cut $800,000 out of your administration. What will be the impact on services to the districts, large and small? We have no idea. Mm-hmm. And you go to another one, Douglas, 261 souls, so they'd have to cut $130,000 out of their administration. And Douglas is one of them that currently get 101% of the state school fund money they get already goes to districts. They don't use any of it. They've got their administration down low enough, and they have some contracts and stuff. And so the districts actually get more in resolution services than the state gives the ESD and state school fund.
So, but then, well, and that's there.
So,
the district's going to have the money. I mean, the money's just going into the district at that point.
But if in the stay with Douglas for a minute, if you'd would, we're going to cut the their total revenue by $261,000. Move 130 of it to the 261 of it to the districts, and the cuts they have to make. 130 of it has to come out of their administrative operations. The other 130 has to come out of the other stuff that the ESD is funding in their 10%. The ESD is already sending to the ESDs, excuse me, the local district, more than they get from the state. If they make this $260,000 cut, it can't all come out of what they're doing out of administration. It's going to have to come out of programs that they're going to have to go back and not provide stuff they're currently providing. And the small district. Douglas has got a lot of small districts. I don't have the numbers with me, but that at $15 a head, I'll bet you they have some districts down there that this means $3,000 to them. And they'll lose a service to kids that they won't be able to repurchase with the $3,000 you're given.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
We held education out of the Capitol meeting in Douglas, ESD. I saw some of the operations going on there. I can't believe that we could expect them to continue to operate entrepreneurial services that bring learning to teachers and students across the state if we mandate a 50% cut in administration when they don't have that much administration to begin with. They got worker bees there getting the job done. Doesn't make sense to me. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Senator. Sure. It's not a 50% cut. It's a 50% of the revenue that 0.25 would have to be administrative cuts. But still hear your point on the fact that there isn't that administration to cut in Douglas.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bozanski.
And regarding the example that's being used, I do have a call in to John Hill. We talked very briefly. He's the superintendent of the Douglas ESD. And there are probably, in my portion of Douglas County, probably close to 12 school districts that make up that part of Douglas County, thereabouts. And then there's definitely probably another, I think they have about 21, maybe 22. In Douglas County. So I'm waiting to get some more information. We were on the floor when you told me that this was going to be here today, and still waiting to get some more additional information as to what that would mean.
Great. Other? Mr. Conkling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Gary Conkling here representing the Northwest Regional ESD, which represents, or includes, I should say, 20 component school districts. Range in size from 500 to 35,000. Jewel, for example, at the small end, and Beaverton at the upper end. Mr. Mabbitt, who's the superintendent, couldn't be here today, interestingly enough, because they're doing a partnership workshop with Beaverton, Tiger Twalt, and Hillsborough officials on literacy, and he extends his apologies. But the statement that I've given you in writing is his own statement that he wrote and I hurriedly prepared today. It's worth noting just a couple of things, and I certainly associate with the comments that Mr. Rose made, but just to add two other points to that. In the Northwest Regional ESD, where there have been some criticisms in the past, under Mr. Mabbitt's administration, many cuts have been made, in fact, laying off people in the central office. A substantial number of reductions have taken place. And I draw your attention to the third paragraph of his statement, which he notes that, in fact, even this year, of the 10% amount of money for administrative allotment to the ESDs, some portion of that 10% is being returned to our component districts. Mr. Mabbitt's view is that if the district, that is to say the ESD, doesn't need it, it should go back to the component districts, and that's the policy that's in place. I've noted, at least in my conversations with the chair, but we'll mention here as well, that under this administration, through the resolution process, school districts in Northwest Regional ESD are able to get up to 50% of the 90% of their dollars that go to services, to take those instead of services in cash. Beaverton is, in fact, taking nearly 50% of its otherwise it would have service credits, if you will, in cash for approximately $3 million. Those are actual dollars that come out of the 5% going to ESDs that turn around and go back to Beaverton as cash payments. And then final point that I would make, that in our case, it's probably similar in many ESDs, but certainly in ours, where we have a number of school districts and county seats where they tend to have group homes and other things, we have a lot of special education children. And 85% of our revenues going for service go for special education. The children that we handle are the most fragile and severely handicapped children. The ESD has expertise in how to handle designing programs, as you know, under federal requirements, where parents have substantial grievance processes. These are significant cost and management issues, but the key is ESDs are there to provide quality education for these students, and that's our job. That's one of the critical things that we provide services to our component districts for, and for which, at least last year, when all 20 of our school superintendents supported unanimously the resolution process and the distribution of both core and special services, that's how the money has been broken out. So with that, Mr. Chair, as you probably could tell, we don't support the amendments to Senate Bill 415.
Great, thank you. Questions or comments for the panel? So, because my marching orders were find $24 million because we needed to reach, so you would be supportive of a lower, just reducing the school funding number by 24 or whatever the requisite number and just leaving it at that. Is that accurate or?
Mr. Chair, the school funding number is irrelevant. This is all part of this. You're just moving around inside the number.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go, actually, I'm in favor of 5, 7, 8 or something, but whatever number you choose is irrelevant to this discussion. It's all going into the K-12 fund. It's how you distribute it. And the 95-5 split and then the 90-10 use of it was all part of creating the equity. We created equity for local school districts. We didn't do anything with the ESDs. And if you recall, there were huge, and you're pretty close to one of them, where there was a huge difference. Mm-hmm. So we said over a five-year plan, we're going to shift it and make all the money be distributed on a per-student basis, with ESDs getting 5% of what's available to the kids on their ESD. And we're in the finally into the fifth year of that happening. And the change in that ratio is irrelevant to the number that you come up with.
Mm-hmm. Other than you might be able to find efficiencies or.
If Douglas County moves $261,000, or whatever that number is, from the ESD to the local school districts. Douglas County is using an old, remodeled Safeway building. It's full of people that do district services for the districts. Over 100% of the money they get from the state already goes right straight into services. There are not going to be any efficiencies. It's going to reduce what the Douglas County can do for its districts. And its districts, many of them down there have 1 and 200 and 300 size districts, I think, the ones that you're talking about, North Brother County. They're going to pick up $1,500 or $3,000, and they're not going to be able to replace the service they've been getting from the ESD that will be cut back with this kind of a cut. It's just, now there are issues that might ought to be addressed, but that this doesn't address them. It's short-term notice that you're going to change budgets for next year, and it will create disarray, but a different disarray in every ESD. Some ESDs, it might not touch the local districts at all. They might have the ability to adjust for it. But it's not going to be the same everywhere. It's going to be totally different. And the smaller the units, the worse the problem's going to be, and the more difficulty it's going to have in getting good services to kids, which is the bottom line.
Good information to have. I can tell you the ones I'm familiar with, the bigger ESDs, I certainly feel like there's economies of scale to be had and efficiencies that I see happening within the school districts. Just one person's opinion, and they would obviously bear the biggest brunt. It's mine that would, on this sheet, would make the biggest cut of all the ESDs. Other questions or comments for the panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else on this? Here comes Tricia Smith. And, yes, long time no see.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, Tricia Smith, Oregon School Employees Association. And I am here on the occasions when I can agree with my management. I try to. And this is one of those moments. We very much oppose the Dash 2 amendments for all of the reasons that you've heard. We are a little disturbed at the myth running around this building that ESDs are fat with money and have lots of room for efficiencies and all you have to do. Well, sometimes if you make them bigger, they'd be more efficient. But then we hear the big ones are the ones that have the efficiencies to be had. So we're not sure what really is an efficiency in the definition of the legislature when it comes to ESDs. We think this is moving deck chairs around on the Titanic. We'd like you to go get some more money for all of us and not cut some to feel like you're helping others.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rob Myers, and I'm here on behalf of the Five Frontier Rural ESDs. And in fact, I didn't intend to testify, but I just want to say a couple of very quick things. I wasn't aware that the amendment included a 50% reduction in administrative costs, basically reverting back to the last year. To relate that to the smaller ESDs, there are virtually no administrative savings to be realized when you've got two people in administration. You've got a superintendent and a deputy clerk. And if it's 50% or 25%, quite frankly, it's irrelevant. It's still a reduction in funding that they can't deal with. The three of the five small ESDs, and you guys have heard this before, but I will tell you once again, return money to the state over and above the amount that they receive. They receive $1 million funding floor right now. Three of them return more than that to the state of Oregon. Are we willing to accept a $50,000 reduction in revenues? We would prefer not to, but if it's something that needs to take place, then we're not going to stand on a rock and refuse to accept that. I also want to make it clear that in Wallowa, for instance, the Wallowa ESD superintendent is also the superintendent at Troy School District and the business manager of two districts in Wallowa County. So, once again, the dynamic in terms of creating a solution that addresses large ESDs, right, wrong, or indifferent, is disproportionately injurious to small ESDs. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions or comments for the panel? Thank you very much. Anyone else on this? I don't think we'll move this bill because I don't think it has the support. I'll just report. Committee, any thoughts or questions? I think what I'll do is report back that I don't. Senator Brzezinski.
I think
Mr. Chair, I think that'd be a good thing to do, is for us to report back. I understand, I think, where the budget chair and budget members are coming from as to thinking what might be able to be done, but I think the one thing we have to realize is that the ESDs are different in size and what they are performing, and there may be some where they could absorb it and it would not be that much of an impact. But if you get into these ones that only have two or three or four people in the administration, we're really talking significant. And I know that's why I was hesitant when we talked about this on the floor, just knowing as to my walkthrough, and I've been to the Douglas ESD numerous times and seen their operation and exactly what that would mean to it. And I think that's something as to, I mean, it's one thing to get the money, and it sounds great to get it back to the schools and the districts to use, but some of these districts are so small and fragile that they cannot provide the service that they get through the ESD for those students that need to have that service. And that's where we basically did the economy of scale, was pooling those resources at the ESD for those within the district.
Thank you very much. The only thing that they're sitting down trying to figure out the school's budget, and obviously I think that's what
ending balance, that's what I would say.
If we had to sit balance in those hearings, I'm sure everyone else here has had to sit in those hearings, and they're just difficult hearings trying to get schools adequately funded, and it's not adequate. So I think that's where you get the pressure on anyone close to the action. Close the... Are we in public hearing?
Yes.
Hearing on Senate Bill 415, and we are adjourned. We are going to... 34. We're going to meet, I believe, Wednesday at 1. If not, it'll be Thursday at 1. And our committee party is the 29th?
29th, next Wednesday.
Next Wednesday is our committee party with the House Revenue Committee.
Cool. All right.